is the voice of the Mysterons. We know that you can hear us, Earthmen. We've seen the greed and corruption of the world in which you live, and will take our revenge upon it. We will destroy the heart of New York. We have not forgotten.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and it's 2025. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 10th of January, Friday, that is, 2025. Streaming live from Eastone Studios in Bristol, one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, also at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you haven't had a play with that yet, do. It actually works. It's quite handy. It does the stuff. Nick's also up for, if you think, oh, it doesn't do this, why doesn't it do that? Can it do that instead? Just ping Nick via the app itself or via me, and he's very good at doing little updates to it. So that's available. Easiest way to get it is via the show page at thisweek.org.uk. Scroll to just underneath the big green button that says download, and you'll find a link to the Android and the Apple version of the app there, because Google, of course, have banned it effectively. Anyway, thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner. I'm Tony Gosling, gaslighting us with its military-grade zero-trust agenda, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. These McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against World War II and wage slavery. And then like people like Craig Murray, just cast them into outer darkness. We're never going to hear from you again because you know what you're talking about. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those so-called solutions to every crisis, whether it's Ukraine, Gaza, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, everything, climate, of course, too, a new one every few months, the twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. Meanwhile, the wife-murdering pantheist Ref King Tampon Charlie and his vampire queen, Carmilla, actually queen consort, she's supposed to be, but no, she wants to be queen, wage war on the British people, as well as on China, Russia and the BRICS, through the panda-eyed energy saboteur Ed Miliband. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? Helping us navigate the WEF's Fourth Reich matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Today we'll be looking at grooming. Obviously Musk has kicked this out because, number one, he wants to embarrass Labour, but number two, he wants the Reform UK and also Mr. Nigel Farage to welcome with open arms Tommy Robinson, the Zionist agent. So this is Mr. Elon's little agenda, but we'll be talking about grooming, someone that really does know about it. Fascinating angle from former Metropolitan Police Detective John Wedger, my go-to chap on this sort of subject, and actually comes out with all sorts of fascinating facts about what's really going on with grooming, and why, of course, there should be another inquiry, which Jez Phillips has just stopped. David Miller, the home front of the genocide, we'll be hearing about him and from him. And also the 7/7 documentary, did you spot that? That was on over the holiday. Oh, God, how disgusting. This is what they're up to. So this, talking about the home front, is having a load of stuff about the 7/7 London bombings with all those nasty Muslims that did it, of course. And this is just, the idea is it's a sort of dog whistle, isn't it? Oh, those evil Muslims. It's a bit like those Palestinians in those camps that are getting genocided. That's what the BBC does these days, I'm afraid. Absolutely vile. Funnily enough, I know somebody who has been saying this is a great film, isn't it wonderful that the director is great, Franny Armstrong. I've known for, gosh, must be 25 years maybe? Oh, 20 years at least, a filmmaker who made the McNeibel film about Keir Starmer back with the Dave Morris and Helen Steele back in the 1990s. And she's finally blocked me on Twitter. I said, look, do you think this is really a great film the BBC are making here, The Home Front for Genocide? So we'll be looking a bit at that. Also, UNN, a little interview with David Clues that I did this week. They are an amazing little outfit, and I just thought it'd be nice to reach out to him and introduce him to our listeners for 2025. In part two, we're obviously looking at the New Orleans, also the going into the Nazis again, Werner Neumann, and his mate was Martin Bormann. Mark Felton's been doing some digging into the Fourth Reich. Very good stuff from Mark. Not quite got there yet, Mark, with Operation Market Garden, Martin Bormann, and Winston Churchill's private secretary, Desmond Morton. And finally, Constantine, Baal and Mithras. So looking at the Vatican, which is really the sort of battle that seems to be going on, has been for hundreds of years, in Europe between the Roman Church and the Orthodox Church. So Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM, it seems like an eon ago now, by the Bristol Mafia, and from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft a bit more recently, last year, by the trans lobby. Anyway, Martin, maybe we should start this week by just looking at the rising, if you can explain this for us, the rising cost of long-term borrowing in this country means that people with mortgages and that sort of thing are going to be having to pay more. So Rachel Reeves seems to have made a bit of a mistake here. And I do wonder if she's jetting off to China, isn't she? What's she doing over there? Is she going to try and get to borrow money off the Chinese or something a bit cheaper? What's she up to?
Well, she'll be going to China to talk about business, British businesses doing business in China. But
getting Chinese investment here?
And Chinese investment here, possibly.
Is there
any
benefit for the British people in that? Or is this...
Well, I mean, if you're going to be part of a capitalist global economy, which we are, you want people to invest in your country. So that's one of the things you have to do is go around and tout for it.
They're only going to be investing here if they can make money out of us, aren't they? So the profits will be going back to China.
Well, in that case, we should just not do any foreign trade at all, Tony, and just produce and knit our own yoghurt
here
at home.
We're not talking about trade, we're talking about investment, weren't
we?
Well,
exactly, but that is part of trade, isn't it? I mean, you know, international investment flows are part of international trade. She's, you know, it's normal. And the actual fact, of course, going to visit China has become very fraught because of the bad relations between China and the West as a result of Taiwan and us joining the AUKUS, you know, with the Australians to provide more nuclear submarines to threaten the Chinese merchant navy. So in actual fact, going, I mean, Baerbock's been the French, the German foreign minister has been over there. She got short shrift because she went over there to lecture them. So they just ignored her and refused to shake her hand. But she's going there because it's in the schedule for her to go there. The increasing long-term borrowing in Britain is largely to do with the Trump factor in the US, because they think that what the markets think is that Trump's tariff policies and all the things he's preparing to do are going to force up inflation in the US. And because it forces up inflation in the US, that means probably that's why interest rates in the US are rising. Now, everybody is dependent on the level of US interest rates, because they're at the core of the world economy. So Britain, like many other countries, is now having a spike in borrowing because of Trump. And of course, once he brings in his tariffs, if he does, there's going to be an almighty crash in Western and Eastern Europe.
How much are these markets in Wall Street in the City of London, how much are they actually just reflecting the honest future projections for investment and returns? And how much are they political?
Well, there's a bit of both going on. It's what's called a dirty float or a managed market. So in other words, the political decisions made by whoever is running the US Treasury affects the mood of the market, and then they move their money around accordingly. I mean, basically Trump is going to rip up all the rules about the way in which countries are supposed to relate to each other. The World Trade Organization is dead. So all of those pro-Brexit people who said, well, we're going to trade under World Trade Organization rules, the World Trade Organization is a dead donkey. and we're going through a tariff world now, where big countries will put tariffs on small countries and bully them around and take their stuff unless they can resist, like the Palestinians are still resisting. What do you think interest rates mean to them?
What's the connection between these wars and the interest rates?
Well, the big massive debt in the US is because of their military expenditure. That's really what it boils down to. So is their trade deficit. All of the money that they spend in and their hundreds of bases around the world then becomes their trade deficit, because that's money leaving the US, and that actually is. And then, of course, they suck in all of these imports. They are at the core of the world economy, and it's what Trump has said, is that, you know, anybody who tries to stop using the dollar, he's going to put sanctions on them, and he's basically saying he's going to put sanctions on anybody he doesn't like. That's the end of the Bretton Woods regime, where we're supposed to have some fair rules that everybody agrees to.
Like the US is, or Trump is going to land in the boxing ring to fight for the Americans, but he's going to be knocked out.
Well, no, he's going to fight for the Americans as he sees it, but that's going to be at everybody else's expense. The United States elite are the enemies of humanity. And, of course, they're probably going to, if there's a war with Iran, which may happen before January the 20th, because of the way things are going, then that will whack up the oil price, which really will mess up Rachel Reeves's little plan. And everybody else's as well, by the way, not just hers.
A little plan. Anyway, we will be talking about the Middle East after the break later, but let's have a little look at Ukraine now, particularly since it seems to be affecting what's going on quite a lot, particularly with the finances. And there's this chap, Colonel Douglas McGregor. I think we had a little listen to him a couple of editions before the Christmas break, Martin. Here he is talking about what he makes of the Ukraine conflict and what's going to happen when Trump arrives.
If Trump comes in and does what you suggest, especially early, and just withdraws our support, withdraws our people, he will be crushed in politically by people saying, oh, you just surrendered. You're a surrender monkey to Putin. How does he navigate that?
Well, first of all, he needs to ignore the foolish statements by people that have cost this nation untold quantities of blood and treasure. Remember, he wasn't elected to extend wars into the uncertain future. Let's step back from the Ukraine situation a little bit and look at Europe. The German government has collapsed. Eventually, and I don't think this will happen immediately, but eventually, new leadership that is nationalist will come to power in Berlin. We've already listened to Alisa Weidel, and she has made the case that neither NATO nor EU, for that matter, are necessarily in Germany's interests. She is correct. Germany is not some sort of serfdom or slave state to be moved about as we decide. The Germans need to get over the post-World War II hangover and reinvigorate their minds and understand that they have a very powerful and productive role to play in Europe to maintain the peace in Europe, which is exactly what Bismarck set out to do when Germany was unified. I think we're going to see more of that. That means the Germans are going to get out of this nonsense. The same thing is true, I think, in Paris. Once you begin looking at the polling data, listening to the people that are discussing the future of France, there's no future for what Macron stands for. That's a dead end. His state is just as stricken with debt as ours is. The era of promising everybody, everywhere, everything for nothing is ending. The so-called New Deal is no longer a fair deal or a viable deal. It's dead. England is in very serious straits. I'm surprised that Starmer is still walking around in charge. I think he's going to be kicked out. So if you look at Europe right now, they're prepared to launch on their own, regardless of what we do and what we say. And the most important state in Europe today is the same state that's been the most important state in Europe for decades, Germany. And Germany has had it. I mean, after all, they have us to thank for the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline. They have us to thank for the deindustrialization of Germany. You know, and if you're looking for puppets who are pathetic, amoral buffoons, you have Olaf Scholz and his sidekick, Annalena Baerbock. These people are done. They're finished. They're on their way out. They'll be lucky to survive in the next 10 years, depending upon what happens in Germany. When the rage, the full picture of corruption and destruction reaches the German people, there's going to be hell to pay in Germany. You're going to have the same thing in France. You're going to have the same thing in Great Britain. So President Trump has to look beyond the buffoonish characters that he's got around him. He's got to look into the future and understand this is not 1965, 75, 85, or 95. This is a new world.
Yep.
Forget all of this, you know, unipolar moment nonsense, which was never real anyway. And stop worrying about, are the Americans as a people going to be upset if they acknowledge that we are not a supreme power everywhere on the planet? They don't give a damn. Get back to basics. Americans care about what's happening here at home. They don't give a damn about Ukraine. Pack your stuff. Get out. Get everybody out of Poland and the Baltic states. Come home. Let the Germans and others negotiate an end to this with Putin, because, listen, they're the ones that have to live with this. How many times do we have to tell people Americans don't live in Europe? We live in the Western Hemisphere. We're worried about our borders. We're worried about millions, tens of millions of foreigners inside our country who are not legally here, who are responsible at least partially for the tremendous increase in criminality. All of this has to be taken seriously. Get the troops back, put them on the border, prepare for the hard work that needs to be done here at home. Forget this nonsense overseas.
Well, I mean, he's in many ways a voice of sanity, especially in relation to Ukraine there. But I think he's overestimating the kickback from the elites in Western Europe. They are absolutely tied into the US system. It's not easy for them to break out of it. And if they try and break out of it, the Americans will break their legs, because Douglas McGregor, with all due respect, ain't in charge.
So what do you make of the possibility that that these foreign interests might reduce under Trump, and him start concentrating more on things like migration, the American economy, that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, that's obviously...
Is it recoverable, is what I'm trying to say?
Well, I mean, obviously, McGregor, I think, probably did vote for Trump. So he's what he wants is for Trump to do what he wants him to do, which is concentrate on US
stuff. But what's the likely... I mean, look, I mean, we all know that these elections are all full of smoke and mirrors. Is there going to be anything, do you think, produced from the promises of Trump to cool things down in the Middle East or in Ukraine?
Well, in the Middle East, he's actually committed to a potential attack on Iran, so we didn't even talk about that. We're just talking about Europe for the moment, so let's just focus on that. I think the problem is that they can't back out because they find it impossible. They're trapped by their previous rhetoric and all the rest of it, and what will happen is Trump will talk. I mean, Trump said he's already talking to Putin, but Putin's office has said, no, we've had no approach from Trump, so he's just making that up. And, of course, the presumption by Trump and people who support Trump, like McGregor, is that Trump will negotiate with the Russians, or perhaps he's saying that maybe the Europeans need to negotiate with the Russians, which is a much more sensible way of thinking of it. But the thing is that the Russians will talk to Trump, but he's not going to walk away with anything other than a defeat. NATO is defeated. And from what McGregor's saying, maybe NATO is dead, just like the World Trade Organization. You know, it's a bonfire of all of this stuff at the moment. And of course, it could be a real bonfire with all of us in it.
So Britain's Foreign Secretary David Lammy, I find that difficult to say, having met him, very close to him anyway, he wouldn't really talk back to us when we were at the Lisbon Bilderberg Conference in 2023, I think that was. They wouldn't let him in, and he had to hide behind a bush and phone a friend to let him into the Bilderberg Conference in Lisbon. But anyway, he had this to say about Ukraine. He had quite a big, it was a very sort of large foreign policy speech, and he was also talking about the grooming gangs. He's going to clamp down on them, apparently. So anyway, let's have a listen to the Foreign Secretary, what he makes of all of this. I think this was yesterday. Yeah, yesterday.
So 6 months after becoming Foreign Secretary, I've gathered you here in the Foreign Office to talk about the future. With the United States, our closest ally, progressive realism means strengthening our friendship with both sides of the aisle, joining them to defend Israel from Iranian attacks. Together with Australia, further progressing the AUKUS partnership and making a breakthrough for UK defence companies thanks to the ITAR changes. Against Russia, progressive realism means not allowing Putin's mafia state to act with impunity and showing the world our resolve to stand by Kyiv until they prevail, guaranteeing $3 billion a year in military aid for as long as it takes, and unlocking a new funding backed by frozen Russian assets, as well as stepping up action with allies on Kremlin disinformation and making it my personal mission to choke off Russian revenues through our sanctions, imposing the most of any country against Russian shadow fleet and driving forward our campaign against kleptocracy. In the face of conflicts in the Middle East and beyond, progressive realism means standing firm against terrorism and behind international law, doubling our aid for Sudan, helping hundreds of Brits leave Lebanon, restoring funding for UNRWA, standing up for international courts, taking tough decisions on export licenses, but not flinching from defending Israel against an Iranian regime that wants to destroy it, while at the same time working for that ceasefire in Gaza so we can surge in the aid, bring all the hostages home, and advance a two-state solution. And when it comes to China, progressive realism means consistency, not oscillation. As I set out when I was visiting Beijing, and Rachel Reeves is continuing this week, pragmatic engagement to cooperate with China where we can, such as on trade, climate, global health, or AI regulation, but also very robust dialogue and challenge where there are clear threats. Sanctioning Chinese firms who supply technologies to support Putin's war, working for the release of Jimmy Lai, calling for an end to human rights abuses in Xinjiang, an end to cyber attacks on the UK, and an end to sanctions on our parliamentarians.
Well, it's what you'd expect to hear. It's boilerplate pro-NATO stuff.
He seems to be taking
What we're just discussing, NATO's about to collapse. Don't tell David Lammy, because as far as he's concerned, NATO is the future just as it was the past.
He's absolutely wedded to Trump and the US policy on bringing the hostages in Gaza home. Now, this, to me, is almost like they don't really want this, but they have to keep saying it, because they know that there's going to be no release of hostages until there's a permanent ceasefire, a guaranteed permanent ceasefire, which the Israelis are not going to allow.
That's right. And of course, the idea that the Iranians are bad actors and we've got to confront them. The Iranians have democratic elections of their own. They're not entirely democratic, but then the elections in Israel aren't entirely democratic, because all of the Palestinians that were kicked out in 1948 don't have any votes in them. And we don't get votes in US elections either. Now, if we don't get votes in elections in other countries, we're not obliged to support their policy. This is a pro-US Labour administration. If we'd had a different administration under Jeremy Corbyn and somebody else being the foreign secretary, we would have been distancing ourselves from the genocide in Gaza, which we are supporting. And of course, the majority of people in this country do not support Britain's supplying weaponry to support that. And we don't want to go to war with Iran to keep the Israelis in the style to which they've become accustomed. We shouldn't be at war with Yemen, but we are.
Do we want to
No other European country is bombing Yemen apart from us.
Does the British people want to go to war with Russia?
No, I think in general they don't, although they've been basically bamboozled by the huge deep state that we have in this country. You know, if you think about what happened with the Skripal affair, it's quite clear to my mind, and anybody's objectively analysed this, that was British intelligence service. Come on. That's all that was. And of course, it's there. It's Operation Beluga. We know the name of it because it was grassed up by a French anti-terrorist officer. The British have been very, very involved in creating incidents, terrorist incidents, in order to make it impossible for any peace to happen between Russia and the rest of Europe. And of course, the assassination of General Kirillov, who's the head of the Russian chemical and biological warfare troops, the Russians are quite clear that they think that the British had a hand in that. And of course, that means that maybe Tony Radican, who's the head of our armed forces, can expect a little car bomb when he comes out, when he comes out on his way for work, because that's where we're going with all of this.
Hamish Brett and Gordon seems to be sort of the cheerleader for that whole thing, saying it's great, great that this guy's dead. Well, you know, at the moment, there's nobody on the Russian side saying we want Hamish Brett and Gordon dead, because they're a bit more mature than that.
They are, but although Dmitry Medvedev, who used to be the president of Russia and is now a senior politician, he said that the Times, who actually crowed about the killing of Kirillov, he said that the Times editorial board might be legitimate targets. I think what the Russians have said about all of this is, we know that you're involved in this. We know that you were involved in the Crocus attack, which killed over 100 of our people, civilians. We know that British Storm Shadow missiles were used to hit a beach in Crimea that killed several people. We know about all of this. And we reserve the right to hit back at a time and place of our choosing.
The Storm Shadow and the ATACMS missiles are now hitting, have been over the break, for example, hitting apartment blocks in major Russian cities. So they seem to be trying to kill civilians with those. But look, when it comes to these assassinations, I'm fascinated. It seems to me that the assassination or the decapitation policy is designed as a sort of psyop to say, oh, look at this evil Russian. We've now got rid of them. Thank God for that, you know. But I wonder if they have any real military value whatsoever.
Well, they do have military value in the sense that war is partly about perceptions, isn't it? You know, so what it does is, it also supposedly, the idea is that by attacking people like Kirillov, of course, is a hero in Russia. So he's been blown up by the Ukrainians working with the British, because the British don't really have much of an army anymore, but we do special operations. Yeah? We say to the Americans, oh, leave that to us.
Maybe we don't need the tanks if we can send a few assassins in.
That's right, yeah. But the point is that we've been provoking the Russians, particularly... you know, the Russians are very well aware that Britain is, in fact, the main guilty party here. Most people in Britain are blissfully unaware of any of these things. But if you think about what happened with the assassination of Kirillov, people in Russia, their boys are volunteering, not being conscripted, volunteering to fight in the Ukraine, and they're taking some pretty heavy losses. Far heavier losses than the British took in any of their wars in the Falklands or anywhere else. But in Russia, they are determined to win this battle, and people are prepared to go forward to die. But of course, it's also the generals, yeah? General Kirillov is a top guy. He's died. Yeah. When was the last British general killed in action?
Well, there was guy called Hayden William Davis. I don't know if you came across this chap. It was nothing at all about him on the mainstream press that I saw. He was an ex-British squaddie who got...
Squaddie?
Got cashiered out of the British Army for smoking cannabis. Ended up, I mean, he tells the whole story in the full version of this, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And I came across, I think it was on Telegram or somewhere, this, but it's a fascinating interview with this young man who was born in Southampton, and he ended up looking around, because he's basically, the only thing I can do is fight. So he joined some sort of mercenary group, found himself in Poland, was transported in to fight for Ukraine. And here he tells a story of how he realised that he wasn't going to fight for the Ukrainians anymore. He was doing some signals work for the Ukrainian army as a British mercenary. And he overheard orders coming down from the top, two soldiers out in the field, to kill people that he believed were civilians. So they were being told to kill them. So he then decided to just get out of it. He'd had enough. And various other people had slowly, one by one, left the Ukrainian army. I mean, they must be absolutely overrun with the problem of desertion. So anyway, let's have a listen to Hayden William Davis now talking. He's now been captured by the Russians, or he willingly gave himself up to the Russians, actually, and talking to them.
Every single country you'd find in NATO has people in the International Legion. French, Italians, Germans, Americans, English. The most are Colombians. Hundreds. The training that we do depends on your platoon. I was heavy guns. We had no heavy guns, so there was no training. We got given two Dishikas, no ammo to learn with, to shoot with, nothing like that. We got given a Mark 19, no attachment for the tripod, so we couldn't take that out or use it. I asked if I could teach the javelin, because that's what I did in the British Army. I got promised yes. No javelins. Nothing like that. We're not happy with command that are happy to allow war crimes to happen. I was in a position. Essentially, my job was just a listening post. I personally heard on the radio for someone to kill three men. But I remember hearing one of the commanders saying, kill them. A different position somewhere. Okay, I don't know which position it was. There was, I'm pretty sure it was a woman and teenage boy. They got killed. All of us that were in the listening post, we'd had enough. There was about 12 people that wanted to break contract at that minute. The money is and your chain of command don't care about you. They do not care. They will use you as meat. They'll say you'll be on a listening post for 3 to 5 days. They'll keep you there for 10 and then send you to a different position. I point blank refused to go to a different position. There was no information. We didn't have the equipment. Another bloke died because of drones and stuff. One bloke ran away. I stayed behind and like just took cover. Ended up getting grenaded again. Not by Russians. I believe it was by Ukrainians. By drone. Believe it or not. At that point, I decided to find a bunker. And I hid in that bunker for nearly 2 months. A great man from South Africa, dead, left in a wooden box in the middle of Turetsk. The body was like 50 metres from my bunker. So I was out looking for food, as I did every day, about 9 a.m. I heard a drone, so I got straight in a building. When I seen another guy, look, he was out of breath, he was running. I was like, quick, in here. I knew he was Russian, like, you could uniform. And when he realised I wasn't a threat, the weapon was down. He gave me a cigarette, literally. Carried me into safety, out of the way of all the drones and artillery that was coming in.
So I'll put a full version of that interview with Hayden William Davis from Southampton, 25-year-old British mercenary captured by the Russians, willingly captured by the Russians, and the appalling treatment, the appalling training, and also he's part of an army that he can hear and his colleagues can hear wanting to get out other mercenaries committing war crimes, Martin. This is the Ukrainian army.
Well, that's right. I mean, the policy at the moment seems to be if we kill civilians inside Russia, they're going to rise up against the Russian government and overthrow Putin because he can't guarantee security. So you saw that after the Crocus attack, where they, you know, the people attacked basically a rock concert, killed hundreds of people, and the Western media, the mainstream media, were crowing about this. Well, this just shows that Putin can't keep people safe, and eventually people are going to rise up against Putin because he can't keep people safe. This is delusionary. In actual fact, people in Russia are quite sophisticated. They've got a sophisticated media environment, every bit as sophisticated as ours, and more so, and most people are very well aware that the British and the Ukrainians are behind these attacks. And instead of making their own, gosh, we've got to stop the war and get rid of Putin, it makes them even more determined that they're not going to be defeated. And of course, they are not going to be defeated, as Colonel McGregor pointed out earlier in this show.
Just looking at some of the local news here for a little while, Bristol and London have been guinea pigs for BlackRock, Siemens, Marvin Rees and the Merchant Ventures road pricing toll schemes. Now they're destroying New York too. So that's one of the things that was sort of smuggled in over Christmas, was New York has now got a kind of ULEZ zone, a bit like here, Bristol, Martin.
Well, I didn't see that, but it's not that surprising. I mean, there's quite a few of them around the world.
It's the only way that the West can make money now is just charging people to drive down the road. It's like, well, it's an old-fashioned toll system. This was one of the things that people got really annoyed with back in the 17th century, isn't it? The early 17th century. Tolls everywhere.
Yes, but I mean, I think this is a matter you may want, if you want, don't forget these tolls are, in theory, supposed to be reducing pollution and so on. So it's not just about raising money, at least in theory. So let's just, you know, and of course, ULEZ was on the ballot in both elections to Bristol City Council and in London, and people didn't care about it enough to kick out the incumbents. So it's an issue, but it's not the issue, is it?
Well, it's amazing to me that people, after all of the other taxes they're paying, say, for example, on fuel, on insurance tax and all that, that you have to pay to just drive out. I mean, we're in a ridiculous situation where if you reverse out onto the road to turn your car around, you have to pay £9 to do it. I mean, this seems to me, Martin, that our governments are getting desperate to just try and find any old way that they can to raise some money off people. And they know that people with cars have got a few bob, because they must have, to put petrol in them. And the idea, I suppose, is to get the poorer of the people that do own cars to just sell them, get rid of them, and start getting buses.
Well, there is supposedly some kind of social objective behind all of this, but for underlying all of this, you're quite right, is lack of money. There's a lack of money because we bailed the banks out. With the top rate of income tax in this country used to be 95% in the 1950s, and then we could fix the potholes in the road, and the Americans could create the interstate highway system, because the top rate of tax in the United States was 96%. Now, is Trump or is Keir Starmer in favour of bringing back that sort of proper taxation? Not on roads, not on cars, on wealthy people. And of course, there isn't any money because we can't do that. That's off the table. That's why poor old Rachel Reeves is in such a problem. She can't raise taxes on wealthy people, but she's got to balance the books. Otherwise, the Financial Times, The Economist and The Telegraph will tell her that she's not being responsible. Of course, she's going to find that she's not going to be able to balance the books, just like in Japan, they've not been able to balance the books for years, and nobody can change that round. Certainly not Nigel Farage, for example, who said that Liz Truss and her budget was the best budget ever. And of course, Liz Truss is now actually suing Keir Starmer for accusing her of crushing the economy.
She's threatening to sue him. I don't know if that's going to go anywhere.
Well, no, most of this anywhere, is it?
Well, it depends what he said in and out of the House of Commons. That's actually the way these things
I
work.
Well, I think most people are going to conclude that's just political stuff.
Yes.
You can't sue for that, can you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like she's sour grapes, really, because she got booted out. But of course, it wasn't really, you know, Starmer is the city friendly boy. Liz Truss wasn't. In fact, it was so bizarre. She was only there for enough time for the Queen to die, and then she disappeared, didn't she?
Well, what the problem with her was is she's heavily, and as is Farage and the others, they're heavily funded by the hedge fund boys. And they are the city. I mean, Elon Musk wants total deregulation of financial markets and so on.
Ooh.
Yeah, well,
ooh.
Yeah. And of course, no danger of anything like 2008 happening. No regulation, that's right. And of course, the problem with this Labour Party we've got is they are basically subservient to those interests. They're not entirely in the pocket in the way that the Tories are, but they're not opposed to those interests. And that's where they think they're going to be able to, you know, be able to keep a constructive relationship with the City of London at the same time as basically screwing everybody
when
else.
When it comes to these marvellous infrastructure projects, HS2, we hear over the break, that was on the 30th of December, is in a very serious situation, the boss says. It needs fundamental reset, the new boss of the company building the high-speed railway has warned. Mark Wilde, chief executive of HS2 Limited, said he's committed to ensuring the railway opens safely and efficiently. Well, he'll probably be gone by the time it does. But they estimated the cost of building the railway would be between 54 and 66 billion, or between 67 and 83 billion in current prices. But appearing before the Public Accounts Committee, the top civil servant, Dame Bernadette Kelly, said these figures were not reliable. An agreed estimate was unlikely to be produced until well into 2025. So they don't know how much this is. You know, this always reminds me of Hinkley C. You know, it's one of those projects that everyone signed off on, but they've got no idea if it's ever going to be finished or how much it's going to cost.
Well, the likelihood is, as we go into what is going to be a depression, is that it won't be finished. And lots of half-built buildings won't be finished either. That's what happens. And that is the danger of running your society around a completely corrupt stock market, which is basically a house of cards.
Anyway, Lord Peter Gross used to own the land, I think it was at Euston Station or King's Cross or somewhere, which has been taken over by HS2. And he had this to say all about it. He thinks it's a Ponzi scheme.
The Oakerby report, which was not independent but was made half honest by Lord Berkeley, talked about 106 for phase one. There is no nothing else but phase one. There isn't even phase one into Houston. They held a phony bid process and awarded it to Lendlease, who couldn't put a brick in the ground, and they're still talking about Lendlease. Every announcement on HS2 by the Department of Transport and HS2 Limited is a lie and has been shown to be a lie for the last 12 years. And for Bernadette Kelly to stand up and say that she and Wild and the others don't know what it's going to cost, the same week as they're putting out figures where they say they know what it's going to cost. Why that woman is in post, I don't know. And the new minister, Heidi Alexander, who doesn't know much anything about railways, is making, when she talked about why government had to make hard choices, she studiously avoided talking about HS2. We are in a really bad place with this government, as we were with the last. Let me not appear to be party politically biased. Our establishment is broken, and honestly don't know what the solution is.
Martin, any thoughts of solutions? He's saying the establishment's broken. Effectively, that was a massive contract fraud. The person behind it was a chap called Lord Andrew Adonis. He himself was a bit of a fraud as an individual, wasn't he? He married one of his students, who was this young girl, had two kids with her, and then finally came out. He said, "Oh, well, actually, I'm gay," and left her. He's a very peculiar kind of character. He seems to change parties as well whenever he feels like it. And he's the chair of the European movement until December 2022, and was chairman of the National Infrastructure Commission till 2017. This is the guy that started it all off. Surely we should have realised that HS2 was some sort of... I think a Ponzi scheme isn't the idea that the actual building of this thing is where all the money's made, and there's no real interest in ever finishing it.
Well, it's about the technical term Ponzi scheme, which is not a technical term, it's a slang term. Ponzi schemes are when you sell financial instruments. You could argue that it's not really a Ponzi scheme. What it is, it's just badly conceived. Now, the problem is, once you've started building something like
that... I'm saying from an accelerationist point of view, maybe it's deliberately badly conceived. What you've got is you've got all this railway infrastructure that you could upgrade. There's old lines you could reopen. This would help with the net zero targets, etc. But instead, no, you're going to build a completely new railway, which is going to shave just a few minutes off the journey time from London to the north.
Well, and also, of course, what happens when you build that kind of arterial railways like that is they actually suck out demand from the peripheral regions and pull it into London. Yeah, so it's not actually that sensible from that point of view. But I mean, once you've committed to anything, building a nuclear submarine, for example, building a nuclear power plant, building a railway, the problem is if you've spent billions on it already, if you don't complete it, then all that money's wasted. Now, at some point, you have to cut your losses, or at some point, you may say, well, we've wasted so much money on it now, we've got to actually finish it off, otherwise we've wasted every penny we've spent on it. Now, this is because of bad decisions that have been taken over decades in this country. There's been no industrial policy in this country since the 1980s.
Jacob Rees-Mogg, that chap you love, he did say, actually, I think this is probably about 3 or 4 years ago, that we've got to stop throwing good money after bad. HS2 is a waste of money, and it always has been.
Well, what will happen is when we get the crash, which is coming, I'm telling you, I keep predicting it, but it's coming, none of this stuff will be completed. None of it. And will have to be a complete reorganisation, probably including complete change of the taxation system so that the wealthy are forced to hand over the money they've stolen from us, because that's what they've done. What happened in the City of London in 2008 is they stole our money, and they've still got it, and we need to get it back off them. They shouldn't have it. That's our money.
Some good news. Billionaire Guy Hans, his property firm has sold the military homes to the Ministry of Defence for £6 billion. If you remember, we've covered this story a few times in the past, where in the John Major government, all of the military properties that the military staff lived in and out of the bases, they were privatised to Guy Hans' firm. which I can't remember the name of right now, Terra Firma's sale of 36,000 properties back to the Ministry of Defence ends a legal fight with the government over housing reforms. So he's made roughly £3.54 billion on this deal, Martin.
Well, that's our money that he's stolen, isn't it?
No, it's not stolen. No. He just got it privatised at a very cheap price when property prices were low. He's now sold all these houses back. He's just doing a bit of a good deal for himself, isn't he?
Well, I mean,
when the property price is high.
I think after the crash and when we've got a sort of Corbynite Labour government, what we would say is we're going to buy it back from you for what you paid for it.
The deal's already done.
Maybe we'll have to just tax it off.
So at least the Ministry of Defence.
Yeah, inheritance tax.
At least the Ministry of Defence have managed to get the married quarters back under their own control, which seems bizarre to me that the military would allow something like that to happen. But that's what happened back in the Meiji.
Lots of what were public assets have been privatised over the years. There's a massive sell-off of public land in this country. Are you aware of that? Lots of public land has been quietly sold off for profit to private individuals and institutions. And it's been going on 4 years under the radar.
So 36,000
theft.
So 36,000 homes have just been nationalised. I didn't hear much about that. It's quite interesting, really. It's a massive part of
public
sector housing.
Yes, if we were really nationalising, we would just impound the houses and say, you're not getting a penny for them. And of course, after a crash, when we've had plenty of starvation in the streets and all the rest of it, we will just take the stuff off them for nothing. Look at the Thames Water, for example. We're not going to re-nationalise it. It's going to be allowed to go bust, and everybody involved in it must lose loads of money, and then we will take it over for nothing. Zero. Zilch. Nada.
So, looking at a bizarre little story, I think it was just before Christmas, which I missed. A man has been arrested for suspicion of rape at the Groucho Club, a celebrity haunt in London that was closed. The man, aged 34, was arrested on Saturday night and addressed in Hertfordshire, the Metropolitan Police said. So this is a bit weird. The Groucho Club, you don't often hear anything much about that, but this is, I don't know how much you know about it, Martin, but certainly the London media, this is where lots of things happen, including rape now, apparently. The Soho Club, which has A-list celebrities amongst its members, has had its licence suspended. Police say there's no suggestion that staff at the venue were involved. So a woman is being supported by specialist officers, the force said, adding that at this stage there's no suggestion employees were involved. The Groucho Club, a private members club in Dean Street, Soho, had its licence suspended by Westminster City Council after a request by the Metropolitan Police on a Tuesday. This is November, end of November, the last Tuesday in November that this happened. Certainly from my experience working in the mainstream press in London, the Groucho Club was where it all happened, Martin, pretty much. A lot of things like commissions being dished out, financial deals being done to finance films, all this sort of thing, all at this little private members club.
Well, it's not that surprising, is it? I mean, you know, there's plenty of other places in Soho, like Ronnie Scott's, which is a private member, not a private members club, but you have to pay to go in. I mean, people go to places to meet people to do deals. Like, so Lloyd's Coffee House was the original, it was a coffee house which became Lloyd's Insurance Mark, you know, the Lloyd's company. This is the sort of thing that goes on, isn't it? People network and do deals.
Aren't the private members clubs around St. James, isn't that where things really happen?
Well, I mean, there's private members clubs and there's private members clubs,
yes.
Isn't there?
Yeah. The military have them, don't they? The special forces have their own as well.
So, yes, there's a farmers club. Yeah, I mean, when my ex-wife Shelley was a member of the farmers club. It's not really as important to say the reform club or whites or all these other places. I mean, you know, the ruling class has always got together. And not just the ruling class, you know, if you're a journalist, you would often find, you know, lots of journalists used to drink in the Groucho Club to get all the gossip.
Well, as a journalist or a writer, commissions is what they used to dish out. One of their famous members is Stephen Fry, who got a knighthood over Christmas. And I interviewed from UNN, Unity News Network, up in Scotland, David Clues, who was tweeting about Stephen Fry, saying, is it really appropriate to give this guy an honour? He's a Groucho boy.
I'm not a fan of Stephen Fry, if I'm being honest with you. Stephen Fry is establishment through and through, does all the voiceovers for Sainsbury's, etc. as well. Very questionable past. He's written some very questionable plays in the past as well. And I mean, yeah, Stephen Fry seemed much more concerned about supposed anti-Semitism than he was about mass slaughter of innocent people. So that's why he's getting the award, I think.
Yeah, it was 23 Christmas. I couldn't find some decent Christmas messages this year. But when Alexei Sayle was so disgusted with Stephen Fry's alternative Christmas message, he did his own one, which was rather better. But, I mean, Fry is an interesting character in that I know for a fact that he's extremely powerful in the media industry, and a lot of people look to him as a sort of unofficial commissioning editor for drama and the arts and even game shows, you know. So he's got a lot of power. What about his plays? You're talking about slightly dodgy plays. What are they?
Well, that was a play. Let me actually try and get you the name because I can't actually remember it. Where he wrote when he was a younger man about a school master. It was. Let me tell you exactly what it's called. Something to do with tobacco, but. It was this tale of a homosexual relationship between a Latin master and his 13-year-old pupil. It was done back in 2002 at the Edinburgh Fringe, and the paedophile schoolmaster then engages in sexual relations with other pupils as well, and they then go off and abscond together to Morocco in the end. So, interesting subject choice from Mr. Fry.
It is. And also, I mean, he's got a relationship with a much younger man. I don't think, in a way, you know, the gay part of it isn't so important. I think we're all aware of the way that wealthy, powerful, elderly people can prey on younger ones.
Very much so, and there is an agenda being pushed there clearly, and it is involving, you know, younger men, and it is very predatory in behaviour. You're dealing with younger people who don't have perhaps money. These are people who are looking for a start in life, and if you've got an elder statesman, they're prepared to give a helping hand, both literally and figuratively, and the television and film industry is notorious for that, where powerful people use their position to exploit others. And there is a double standard there, because clearly if it was a man doing it to a woman, then they would be called out, they would be the worst person in the world. But if it's a man doing it to a younger male, then everybody seems to just not have an issue with that.
So that's David Clues from UNN, are very prolific on Twitter, got their own website and various other social media. Always seemed pretty spot on to me in picking up on this, but very, very quickly picking up on this award. Stephen Fry has already changed his Twitter feed to Sir Stephen Fry. But this play he wrote, Latin or Tobacco and Boys, it's about a homosexual affair between a teacher and his 13-year-old pupil. This was going to be staged, and then they decided not to stage it because they thought it was a little bit... what Fry is saying in his defence about this play is really it's just about homosexuality. It's not about paedophilia.
Well, since I'd never heard of the play or seen it, I haven't really got a comment to make about that. I mean, if you remember, Nabokov wrote a book, Lolita, that came out in the 1960s about a relationship between an older man and a teenage girl.
But it's art.
It's not necessarily... This is the language used around this play, right?
Celebrating, as Fry would say, the love of a man for his 13-year-old student.
Well, that is definitely...
But it's not about love, it's a homosexual relationship.
Yes, okay, but I mean, the point is that you can write a play about something like that, which might be critical of the older person doing that. You see what I mean? And I haven't seen the play, so I don't know. So it's not really, I don't want to comment on that because I don't know what was in it. But Sir Stephen Fry is very much an establishment figure. He went to Cambridge, he went to private school, which he was kicked out of because he was involved in various criminal activities, theft with a credit card and so on. But of course he was allowed back in because he's got very, you know, he's a creature of privilege. And of course, as you know, last Christmas, not this Christmas, he made an appalling kind of Christmas message about how he felt threatened as a Jew by all of this protest about Gaza and so on. Of course, Alexei Sale, who was also Jewish, trolled him completely and said, you know, it has come to my attention that certain elderly Jews have decided to have a Christmas message. So, as we know, Alexei Sale had his own Christmas message. And of course, you know, Stephen Fry, I'm sure, probably guessing his politics, he's probably a New Labourite, isn't he? He's a Starmer friend, I imagine. Really?
But anyway, the fact is, he's extremely powerful, and now he's a Sir. He's very much part of the establishment, as David Clues said. And I'll put the longer interview with David Clues and UNN up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But in the meantime, I also asked him about the Scottish Government, what he made of the Scottish Government, Scottish independence, and the Brexit referendum too.
I am a very different person. Not person, I'm still the same person, but my thinking has evolved over the last 5 years. And really the pivotal change for that was the COVID scam and what happened in March 2020 and the way the government behaved nationally, the way the media behaved, and the way the political class behaved. And after that, there was really, that was the Rubicon cross. There was no going back. And as you say, the whole sort of left-right thing, it doesn't really exist anymore. It's nonsense. It's garbage. Clearly, there is so much overlap between different people and different ideas that I think the days of the whole left-right divide are gone now. And that's the hard part for the political class, because it's no longer BBC One and ITV. It's no longer Labour or Tory, red or blue. There are a lot of different shades. The choice is there and the shades are there now.
What about Scottish independence?
Well, I'm against Scottish independence just intrinsically because I believe in the nation state of the United Kingdom. I believe in our shared history. And I also believe that what they are offering isn't really independence. What they're offering is more NATO, more European Union. And in any globalized world with Vanguard and BlackRock, I mean, BlackRock, what, $11 trillion under management? I mean, what's, say, the whole of Scotland's worth, what, a few hundred billion? I mean, BlackRock could just buy you and ruin your country. So the idea of independence isn't, they're not offering independence, they're just offering a different managerial structure. But if I was actually talking about that the other night on my show, if the Scottish government turned around and said, look, we're going to put all the woke stuff away, we're not going to join NATO, we're not going to join the EU, but we'll have a good relationship with them, we won't support any wars, we'll restore our borders, we'll crank up the oil and gas again, or we'll be an energy independent country, I think they would win a referendum on it. I wouldn't support it, but I think they would win, and I don't think it would be the end of the world.
Is he right there? That is it more of a genuine in the independent Scotland that they're more likely to win?
Well, I mean, this is a matter for people who live in Scotland, because, of course, the SNP have been trying to get an independence referendum to win it
What he's saying is that they're not actually really campaigning for independence. They're campaigning for something which is aligned with BlackRock, the States, NATO, the EU, and so that is an independence. And isn't he?
Well, I mean, is Britain an independent country?
No, of course not.
We've left the EU, but it seems to me that the Americans tell us what to do.
That's just a diversion from the question. No. It is possible to have an independent country, isn't it?
Is it? That is the question, isn't it? In 1981, Tony, the Mitterrand government in France decided that they weren't going to pursue a Thatcherite policy, as was happening on the other side of the channel. The communists were part of the government of the socialist Mitterrand, and they tried to expand the economy in the face of the global recession. In other words, we're going to spend money to try and prevent France from going...
So you can have a nice hoo-ha about Scottish independence, but actually it's just hot air.
Well, just let me finish my point.
I know what you're saying.
The point is that the franc then collapsed, yeah, and the government collapsed. Now, if a big country like France cannot defy the US financial markets, a small country like Scotland definitely can't. Now, that's also true for a small country like Britain, and it's true of any country.
We're not small. We're big. We're very important.
Not as big as Russia.
Anyway, one thing I love about David Clewes and the UNN is he does take in all the sort of bigger picture. So I asked him about possible solutions. Can we really change anything?
You go back to what Corbyn offered. You know, Corbyn wanted to borrow a few hundred billion and change things, and the Tories said, "Oh, don't vote for him. You'll have immigration running at 750,000 net a year, and we'll have borrowed nearly a trillion." Well, the net immigration that the Tories ran at 1.2 million, and the borrowing costs and the money printing went off the charts. So clearly, the last real threat to the hegemony was Corbyn. Now, I'm not a massive fan of Corbyn. I don't really like a lot of his politics, but he offered a genuine change. He offered something different. And his attacks on Zionism, his attacks on the power structure, he was simply prevented from being the next prime minister of this country. So how is change even possible? Even if you look at Farage, Farage is a safety valve. He's not offering change from a right-wing conservative perspective. He's a safety valve. So if you look at the way the British regime works, it manages to just stop anybody changing anything, whether it's from the left, from the right. Now, again, on to Thatcher. I wasn't a huge fan of Thatcher, but Thatcher was in many ways a revolutionary leader, and a lot of the British establishment didn't like her. I mean, obviously how it all turned out wasn't ideal. I just think you're just going to have this dull, boring, managerial class of politician who does nothing. And that's what Starmer is. Just like a bureaucrat, a man in a grey suit, or a woman in a fancy suit who'll impress you. The farmers are just too weak. They're nothing like their colleagues in Europe. And again, the problem with the farmers, Tony, I sympathise with them. I like them, but that rally they held, they had Kemi Badenoch, they had Ed Davey. It was run by an Aster that was running it. It was just basically, oh, this isn't fair. We're going to have to pay too much inheritance tax. That's not going to get you sympathy from the public. The other problem the farmers face, Tony, whether they like it or not, is the big argument during the 80s was no miners, no coal. Well, you can buy coal from somewhere else, no shipyards, no ships. I mean, the way the world is now, you can just fly food in from abroad. So that the farmers really need to up their game and get the public on side and show that they are an intrinsic part and fibre of the country. I hope what might happen is just the whole system kind of collapses. That if the left could, because again, the mistake people make is they think Starmer is like a socialist. He isn't. Starmer represents Zionist neoliberalism and continuity of the existing order. So, I mean, again, Corbyn needs to grow up here and actually go out and destroy the Labour Party. Maybe Farage can destroy the Tory Party. And then maybe in that chaos, genuine people can emerge, and people who just aren't bought and paid for by foreign interests.
So that's David Clewes from UNN up in Scotland. Full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I quite like that way he finishes there by saying, why can't Corbyn destroy the Labour Party and Farage destroy the Tory Party? You know, he's obviously one of those people like us that see this whole sort of red versus blue. Actually, I'm on the red microphone this week. You're on the blue one, Martin, so maybe we're in America today. This whole concept has got to go. There's a political stitch-up. Do you think change is possible?
Well, change is inevitable, is the truth.
Well,
of
their
the
change.
Well, yes, but it's not necessarily going to be positive. Change
you're
is
smiling
inevitable.
When you say that.
Well,
in a grim sense of humour.
Well, I mean, in many ways, I can't wait for the crash, which I've been predicting for years.
Well, yeah.
But of course,
you've been praying for it for the last 15 years.
It will be. What's going to happen in Europe now as a result of what the Americans have done to us, and the Israelis are also, of course, parties to this, is we're going to have a horrible, horrible time in the next generation. I'm 65 years old. I won't see the end of it. Younger people will have to live through it. It will not be fun. Ask the Ukrainians. Yeah, they've lost 1 million of their young people in a war that should never have been fought, supported by our ruling class. And this is as big as that's as big as the First World War. And at the end of the First World War, there were revolutions, were there not? And of course, that's possibly what's going to happen here. But let's not get carried away. Revolutions are often very, very unpleasant, and they don't necessarily result in anything better than what you started with. But you have to have them because change is inevitable.
Well, I'd like to look now at the case of David Miller, because we've heard, I don't know if you'd heard, Martin, yeah, that Bristol University have decided to appeal against his employment tribunal decision, which was that he was unfairly dismissed. The university said that he was anti-Semitic, and the judge in the employment tribunal said, actually, no, his anti-Zionism is a protected characteristic, and they can't sack him as an anti-Semite, because he wasn't an anti-Semite, he was simply an anti-Zionist.
Well, that's right, and of course it's rather spiteful of Bristol University to appeal.
Wasteful. They're always saying that they haven't got enough money, Bristol University.
Yeah, well, the reason they're doing this is because it's an attack on their reputation. They have been shown to be bullies, basically. And if they can overturn this on appeal...
Genocidal bullies?
Well, you may say so, Tony. Everybody...
Supporting the genocide here in Britain, yeah, that's what they're doing, isn't it?
Well, ultimately, this is what's going to happen. As these Palestinians die, as we go into the next 2 or 3 months, they're all going to die of cold and starvation. And any politician...
They are dying. Yeah.
They are. And any politician or institution in this country who doesn't stand up and be counted, their names are going in the little black book. That's all I'll say.
So, well, you don't have to put it like that, in that threatening manner. Surely at some point there is going to be some kind of Nuremberg trial. The Nazis went on
for
10 years. Nazis were committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, with impunity. Then it came to 1946, didn't it?
Yes, but most people who were only a small minority were dealt with through legal means. Most of the people, the SS, for example, were killed by the Red Army in combat. And of course, that's what's going to. I've just mentioned a million young people in Russia. That's
actually
probably
quite
what the figures
a lot
are.
Of quite a lot of senior Nazis who were making policy managed to get away scot free.
That's right. NATO was built up using Nazi intelligence apparatus.
Heusinger. I don't know. Do you remember him? He was a Nazi chief of staff for the Nazi Wehrmacht, and then he was made chief of staff for NATO.
That's right, and the head of Reinhard Gehlen, the head of the Gestapo, was made head of the West German intelligence services. And of course, the Russians are very well aware that at the core of NATO is this rapprochement between the Nazi regime in Germany and the Anglo Zionists, us.
Well, we will be hearing at the end of this programme from Mark Felton, who's been looking into Werner Neumann and his plot to control German politics after the Second World War. Very interesting work he's been doing, which sort of complements my stuff on Bormann, I think, quite a bit. But anyway, looking at other aspects of the, I call it the home front in the genocide, which is the way that various British institutions, including here the BBC specifically, spending lots of public money, much of it going obviously to Tony Blair for his appearance on this documentary about the 7/7 London bombings. I don't know if you've seen any of them, Martin, have you?
No.
Every evening on BBC Two, they've had a series of documentaries, which I'll put a link to up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, all about the London bombings. And I just wonder, because it's not actually 20 years since it happened. It's going to be 20 years in July, but the BBC couldn't resist it. They had to put it out over Christmas. This, to me, this is an obvious attempt to... an Islamophobic attempt to encourage people to think, oh, the Muslims are terrible, they carried out 7/7 for British audiences and families over Christmas.
Well, as you know, Tony, at the time we went comprehensively into all the holes in the official story about what happened on 7/7. And of course, being as I am who I am, we also know about what happened in Italy in the 1970s. That's when the BBC, as any of the people who've made this film watched any of the Gladio documentaries,
I very much doubt. Do they talk about P2? I don't hear them talking about
indeed.
P2 at all.
In other words, most people are blithely unaware or complicit in the fact that NATO is in fact a terrorist infrastructure. Al-Qaeda was created by NATO. NATO created Al-Qaeda. It didn't exist. NATO created it.
But the BBC film sort of interviews lots of people who are involved in 7/7 and talks about how terrible it was for them losing their loved ones, which it obviously was. But they're not... this is, in a way, a kind of dog whistle thing, isn't it? It's pulling at the heartstrings. Oh, those terrible Muslims.
Yes, they interview Peter Power and having his very bizarre...
exercise
on the day, which turned out to be exactly what happened. Did they interview Netanyahu, who got a warning?
The same three tube stations that the actual bombs went off, which is billions to one chance of that. And he said it's a spooky coincidence.
Spooky coincidence.
In a way,
very spooky,
you know, this is just a load... as in MI5.
Yes.
Right? But anyway, on our little documentary, in fact, one of the things that proves to me that people don't like what we do here is the way that if you put 10 years after 7/7 and into the search engines like Google or the YouTube search, you never find our documentary that we did, Martin, 10 years after. I'd say it's a documentary. It's about 30 minutes of reviews.
Well, it wasn't 10 years after, was it?
We did it in 2015 with Fran, if you remember.
Oh, well, I'm thinking of the one Adrian did.
No, this is our one we did on this show, which is
a
compilation.
I'm thinking of Adrian's
video. A bit of a compilation of everything.
Yeah.
And there's also another video called Ludicrous Diversion, which is excellent, which looks at all of the problems with the official narrative. But anyway, we're going to have a listen now to our good friend, Fran Armstrong, who's not with us anymore, but she contributed to this as well. This is the documentary that I've done, which is the search is just Do Not Find, and I'll put a link up to it, obviously, because you can find it from a link, but not through a search. It's called 10 Years After 7/7, 13 Holes in the Government and Media Account of the 2005 London Bombings, as a sort of way of showing that what the BBC are telling you is simply a part of the truth, which is an official narrative. Basically, it's pro-genocide propaganda.
This next stage for you, then, an independent inquiry,
yes.
Not a public inquiry,
no.
An independent inquiry,
yes.
Is vital for you?
Well, it's very important for me and the other members of the families, but the systems and the processes that were in place then, which patently failed to prevent the bombers, are still the same systems and processes that are in place now, and the government have chosen to maintain that status quo, and I think that's really worrying, and it's also important that we find out why the government told such untruths.
Graham, thank you very much indeed.
Graham Fawkes there, who's lost his 22-year-old son. I'm also joined by Fran Anderson. Hi, Fran, who knows a bit about Mohammed Siddiqui Khan.
Hi there, Tony. Yes, Mohammed Siddiqui Khan and Shehzad Tanweer, two of the alleged bombers, were trustees of the ICRA charity bookshop and youth outreach in Leeds. This was a centre distributing extremist Islamic media, and the man running ICRA was Martin McDade, an ex-special boat service soldier. He supposedly converted to Islam, and Newsnight reported that a youth worker at ICRA called Mark Hargreaves says that McDade had a hidden agenda, as he was deliberately grooming young Muslim men and was espousing the most extremist Muslim agenda.
So that's Fran Armstrong there, chatting back in 2015 in our anniversary programme for the London bombings, looking deeply into it. Martin McDade, an amazing, interesting character, ran the ICRA bookshop where two of the alleged bombers came from in Beeston in Leeds. But he didn't just do that, as Fran goes on to explain, in a different clip, actually, he was actually taking them over to Cumbria to train them in insurgency, you know, kind of do military training with them. He's from the Special Boat Service.
That's right. And of course, underlying all of this, I mean, people who listen to this show every week are probably aware that that NATO intelligence services have been involved in the commission and act of terrorism for decades. And it goes back to the 1940s, and they've been doing it for years. The Russians, we were talking earlier about the Ukraine, the Russians are very well aware that the attack on the Crocus Theatre in Moscow was carried out by Western intelligence services working with jihadi auxiliaries. Just as we've now got the situation in Syria, where Al-Qaeda Syria are being airbrushed up as a new government for Syria. Incidentally, of course, there's going to be no elections in Syria for at least 4 years. So this guy who's taking over now is a dictator. And of course, they've also been killing loads of people. Not that you're going to see that on the BBC, where they're so worried about the rich people who are losing their homes to the fire in Los Angeles.
Well, several people wrote to West Yorkshire Police with Freedom of Information requests about Martin McDade. And after several months, West Yorkshire Police wrote back. Actually, it says here in 14th of April 2023, saying, unfortunately, we cannot give you any information. Section 17 of the Freedom of Information Act provides a public authority which, in relation to any request for information, to an extent relying on a claim information is exempt, must at the time for complying give the applicant a notice which states the fact, specifies the exemption of questions, and states that it would not otherwise be apparent why the exemption applies. So basically, they're telling to take a running jump. We're not going to tell them. Now, that implies to me that this guy was still in some way involved with the military in this country.
He probably was an agent. That's the obvious conclusion to draw. I think Sherlock Holmes or Inspector Clouseau might be able to work that one out. Another interesting thing, of course, about the 7/7 bombings is that people we know went to talk to Connex Rail at Luton, and they said, well, we're surprised that you've turned up to talk to us. We thought the police would have come here, because the train that they claim the bombers caught that day from Luton did not run. And, of course, eventually, John Reid, who was the Home Secretary at the time, had to admit in the House of Commons, it has come to our attention that the train from Luton that day did not actually run, but it doesn't change anything, blah, 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 blah. Except it does change everything, because the bombers cannot possibly have been in the times and places they said they were if that train didn't run. Now, the police, what sort of a police investigation is it where the police don't establish the train time? Citizen journalists establish the train time. The other very important point is, of course, Netanyahu had a warning and did not go out of the embassy that day.
Yeah, but we don't often hear that the SBS trained two of the alleged bombers. In this case, say West Yorkshire Police, we have not yet reached a decision on where the balance of the public interest lies in respect of the above obligations and your Freedom of Information request. So that's April 23, no answer.
As we know, they're just covering things up. And, of course, the bomber at the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester had definitely been working with MI6 as an insurgent in Libya. He'd been in Libya fighting with our special forces, and then he came back and blew up the concert, according to the story. Now, of course, what the Russians suspect, the Russian secret services, and I think they're right, that virtually all of these jihadi groups are, in fact, glove puppets of Western intelligence services. And if you think about it, who are our big allies in the Middle East? The Israelis and the Saudis. Now, British military personnel are, as we speak, embedded with the Saudi military and the Saudi Mukhabarat. And, of course, the Russians are very... It used to be just people like us saying these things, Tony. Just crazy alternative journalists, you know. What do they know? But I think the real problem for them now is they're up against the FSB, the Russian secret services. They know very well that the Crocus attack was carried out by British intelligence forces.
Well, it might well
and they're
be...
And they're going to... they're not going to blow British people up, but they're going to take their... You know, they're going to sort things out in their own way.
With regard
to
the genocide, which I'm trying to focus on here, and the home front to that, they're also up against someone called Baroness Saida Varsi, who's just brought a book out about Islamophobia.
Everything from the way in which the disengagement process has been dealt with, more recently, the Shamima Begum case. Here we ended up with a situation where whether Shamima Begum is a saint or a sinner, she's our saint or sinner. She was born here, she was raised here, she's held no nationality other than a British nationality. They've stripped her of a citizenship and effectively made her stateless. We've now created two classes of citizenship. a Class A of people whose heritage is effectively essentially white, and a Class B of all these people from various countries who have been here now for four or five generations, and before that, by the way, lived within the British Empire. So their relationship with Britain goes back hundreds of years, who are now Class B citizens.
Can I ask you, you rose, as I mentioned, in your career, you rose to some of the highest posts in government. You were chairman of the Conservative Party. You were in the Foreign Office, you were Minister of Faith and Communities. That's top table stuff. And that was up until 2014 when you resigned on a matter of principle from the Cabinet. Why was it you were not able to shape and change things from within government that you were obviously acutely aware of, that led to this Islamophobia in policy making?
Yeah, I think much of my fights within government were actually documented at the time, because many of them in some way were leaked. And they're also documented in detail in my first book. So there is no doubt that my time in government, my four or five years in cabinet, were fraught with constant fights on these issues.
What was it that stopped them listening to you? They put you on this pedestal. You were the first woman Muslim cabinet member. Are you just saying that's it, you were window dressing?
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, and there was some battles, certainly in the early times, with, I think, the support of the Liberal Democrats, which meant that we did manage to have some early wins. But some of the kind of more pernicious stuff around making prevent, for example, putting it on a statutory basis and putting this aspect of our counterterrorism strategy in the heart of schooling, where effectively we've had thousands of referrals of British Muslim children to this process, which have subsequently turned out to be completely without any basis. And the stigmatizing of a whole community and the silencing of a whole community and a whole generation through that process, that was only brought in on a statutory basis once I resigned.
Yeah, gaslighting these school kids. I mean, her book is just out at the end of last year, called latest book. I think she's got another one called The Enemy Within, which is from a while ago. But this one is called Muslims Don't Matter, Martin.
Well, I mean, she was a member of the Conservative Party, and
she was the boss.
Yes, she was a. When she says that the Conservative Party is Islamophobic, you can take it to the bank. She knows. She's not an outside criticiser. She was an insider, and she knows very well. And of course, what she won't be doing is doing the stuff we're doing about analysing what happened on 7/7. She doesn't bother to talk about that kind of thing. But in actual fact, maybe we should, because of course, underlying all of this is a truly wicked agenda by the deep state in this country to demonise a whole community so that we can go to war and kill millions of people.
And I remember
totally wrong.
That little documentary thing we did, Martin, back in 2015, you start off with the words, "And this terrorist scourge is their work."
Indeed. This is the point. And now, as I said just not long ago, Tony, it used to be when we were talking about 9/11 and 7/7 and all these other, bombing of Bologna railway station and all the rest of it, it's very much a minority thing. Oh, well, that's the sort of thing conspiracy theorists say or whatever. But the conspiracy theorists now are the Russian FSB. Okay? We're at war with Russia. The Russians know very well that a lot of these extremist jihadist groups are run by Western intelligence services, like the Turkish MIT, British MI6. MI6 were the lead agency in Operation Cyclone, which took jihadists from all over the world, particularly from Tripoli in Libya, and funneled them into fighting Afghanistan with training from the SAS and the SBS. Well, this is all on the record, and nobody can deny it. It's on the record.
Well,
the story is that they just suddenly decided they were going to turn on us. But in Syria, we're working with exactly the same people as we were 40 years ago. Exactly the same. So nothing's changed, and the Russians know very well.
So let's turn now to Bristol University's role in perpetuating this genocide, and hopefully some heads will roll there at the coming Nuremberg trials. What they're doing is they're trying to overturn the judge's decision to award damages to David Miller for unfair dismissal. He's saying that anti-Zionism is a protected characteristic. The judge agreed with him. Now, Bristol University is throwing a load of money at trying to overturn that decision in an appeal, and here's David Miller speaking about it on Al Jazeera last week.
How stifled do you feel academia is when it comes to talking about pro-Palestinian issues?
Well, it's extremely stifled. It's not just academia. I mean, I think this case, of course, is in relation to me as a professor of political sociology, but it also is a case which, once the precedent is established, will affect every worker in the country, whether they are working in the police or in parliament or anywhere. Every worker will be affected. But, of course, there's not just academics who have been subjected to censorship and sacked as a result of their views or their expression of their legitimate views. It's also been a whole range of other professionals. There have been many doctors and lawyers and accountants, even opticians or child psychologists who have been sacked as a result of speaking out on the genocide in Gaza. Because, of course, the Zionists cannot stand the possibility that people speak up for the Palestinians. And they, in order to try and avoid losing the global public relations war, which is what's happening, they are trying to have people sacked so that they can no longer take a place, take a role in public society.
What impact has all of this had on you and your professional life?
Well, I have been sacked from my position. I have not been able to get another academic job. I will not ever be able to get another academic job. And of course, that's a significant detriment to me. It's meant that I've had to find other ways to make a living. And of course, I've done that by devoting myself to journalism and writing, especially on the Zionist movement. So I think maybe if the Zionists thought that they could shut me up, they will now realize that they have been unsuccessful, because, of course, I've made this into a massive issue of principle. And as a result, more and more people are supporting the kind of views which I've expressed, which prior to the beginning of the genocide were much less popular.
The Jewish students I read on the Bristol campus said that they felt unsafe and unprotected. I wonder what your response to that is and whether they were indeed unsafe at any stage. And also what other students felt about your beliefs, your anti-Zionist beliefs, whether they appreciated receiving a range of different ideas.
Well, students certainly do appreciate receiving a range of views. Students who are not Jewish, and indeed students who are Jewish. There were many Jewish students in my classes who did appreciate the range of views that they were given. And I also had many Jewish students who had been on the campus in Bristol who had been excluded, in fact, by the Jewish Society, which is a Zionist society, because they weren't sufficiently Zionist or were anti-Zionist. So, of course, there was no actual lack of safety, and there was no actual problem for the Jewish students who were Zionists, because none of them actually were in my classes at all. The ones who complained had never been to any of my classes and had never spoken to anyone who had ever been in any of my classes. So the whole thing was a farrago invented in order to try and target someone who was willing to criticise Zionism and to talk about Zionism.
Yes, I think the thing I admire most about David is, despite all this bullying, and he's actually kind of upping the ante in a way by going into journalism. People all around the world are seeing him on Palestine Declassified, but not, of course, here in Britain, where Press TV has been banned by Ofcom.
Yes, and of course, in a way, the Bristol University are doubling down on failure, aren't they? If he wins the appeal, then they will look even more stupid. And of course, you know, we've got all the Palestine Action people who are in prison who went and attacked the Elbit Systems factory up in Filton.
There's something very perverse about the university trying to use money to close an academic down they don't agree with. It's not really the practice a university should be pursuing. Well, especially in the context of the genocide.
I would argue that Bristol University is going to look very bad out of this. They ought to have just accepted the result. They went to court, they lost, they should have just paid up. And that would have settled the thing in the terms of, you know, Bristol University's reputation. Now, what Bristol University's reputation is becoming, you are pro-Zionist and pro-genocide, aren't you, Bristol University? That's what you're saying. You're making quite clear that rather than accept what has been agreed in court, in Bristol Crown Court, you're going to challenge it. Okay, you're going to challenge it. You are racist. That's what you are. That's what you are, and we're going to call you out. It's called freedom of speech, and we're going to call Bristol University is a racist institution. Baroness Wasi was saying the Conservative Party is racist. That's freedom of speech. Nigel Farage is a racist. I've said it. There you are. Freedom of speech.
Okay. So the other thing is that at the moment there's been some criticism of David Miller. Always interesting to hear that from Adam Johannes, who's been on this programme. In fact, I think he was here to talk about the NATO conference in Newport, and he was one of the people who was organising protests outside there. He's based, I think, in Cardiff or Newport. Anyway, he's posted that before Christmas, David Miller appeared for a second time on the Stu Peters Show, which was discussing topics exposing secret Jew front groups and global tentacles of Zionists. Well, to be fair to David, it's not up to him what label that the Stu Peters Show decide that they're going to put on the show after it's been pre-recorded. Anyway, he goes on, Stu Peters is an American far-right white supremacist, anti-Semite, conspiracy theorist. One of his recent documentaries is titled Hollow Hoax, Fake Gas Chambers, Fake Pictures, Fake Holocaust. Around the time Miller was appearing on his shows, Peters posted a picture of himself holding Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf with the caption, Visionary Leader. David Miller was advertised as appearing on the Stu Peters Show alongside guest Lucas Gage, an American neo-Nazi and former chairman of the National Youth Front, a white nationalist group. Gage is a prominent anti-Semitic influencer who promotes ideas like the supposed threat of white genocide through immigration. And he carries on, David Miller must be aware of who these people are, blah, blah. But is he wise, do you think, to go on these far-right programmes, Martin?
Well, you better ask David, because I don't know anything about this programme. I don't know, you know, he went on. I mean, don't forget, people can go on a programme to put their point of view, and they don't control who's running the programme or who else is on the programme.
Adam Johannes is saying you shouldn't go on programmes. So I think Tony Greenstein has said a similar thing about this particular appearance pointed out by Johannes and others. But anyway, David Miller very quickly responded the day after. He said, I take the major form of racism in our society today to be Islamophobia. I also take the primary geopolitical anti-imperial struggle of the day to be the struggle against Zionism and the genocide in Gaza, Palestine. I'm afraid my accuser's views express an outmoded anti-fascism, anti-racism. This is in hock to the Zionists and unwilling to offend them. It's certainly not focused on defeating them. It has been out of date for many decades, stretching back as far as the 1970s and early movements like the Anti-Nazi League and Rock Against Racism, perhaps beyond to the 1940s, as I suggested in research on this period. As a result of this model, most of the left and the British anti-racist movement has tried to collaborate with the Zionists in building an anti-racist, anti-fascist movement. But this collaboration always comes with a price. The price is selectivity about the kinds of racism that are seen as significant or identified, and also a refusal of one's Zionist comrades to allow challenges to Zionism as an inherently racist ideology. This has concrete effects, he says, not just in Palestine, but in the UK, most notably in the encouragement of elite and popular Islamophobia via neoconservatism and street movements, respectively. He's talking there about Tommy Robinson.
Well, I mean, I'm increasingly of the view that we've got to have freedom of speech. I don't mind what Elon Musk says, but I'm going to say what I think about Elon Musk. These people may be white supremacists. I have no idea. It might have been unwise for David Miller to be on their show. But in any case, it doesn't mean that he is a white supremacist if he's on a white supremacist show.
David Miller also points out, he says his accuser is a supporter of the Syrian revolution and an anarchist of some sort. He says the so-called revolution in Syria is nothing more than a Zionist NATO CIA-supported move to destroy the axis of resistance.
Well, there you are. So in other words, there's going to be different views of things. As you know, on this show, Tony, we've had all sorts of deep. We've had an absolutely crazy, from my point of view, ex-Jewish, Israeli, Christian Zionist with absolutely mad and genocidal views. But we didn't say shut up. We said tell us about it, and we're going to say what we think.
And he also
you're
says
a racist.
If the criteria is that we must not go on shows where the journalistic outlet, presenter, or guests are racist, there wouldn't be few shows left to go on. You couldn't go on GB News and not the BBC, where the genocidal Rafi Berg sits astride editorial clearance on the genocide.
Well, that's right. If we're going to have this idea that everybody's got to have their say, then everybody's got to have their say. And that includes people who are going to say, no, you're a racist. Okay, well, and if you don't like that, well, you know, cover your ears.
Yeah, he says, it's notable my accuser doesn't criticise me for associating with Peter's alleged anti-Muslim views. That's because one form of racism or prejudice is held by my accuser as sacrosanct. Anyway, so I'll put some links up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, but I thought it was quite interesting what David Miller was getting himself into there. Martin, what do you make of these sorts of debates? His latest thing David's been saying, by the way, is that the Iranians need to get nuclear weapons.
Well, that's a view, isn't it? Of course it is. If the right wing in Israel, and they certainly are threatening to use nuclear weapons on Iran, you can see that the argument in Iran was, well, maybe we've just got to have them. You know, if Britain can have them, and we're not under threat from anybody, really. Nobody's threatening us. But, I mean, the Iranians are definitely being threatened. I mean, Sheldon Adelson, whose wife gave Trump $100 million to get elected, he said we should turn Iran into a car park. So, in other words, he's just saying, let's just nuke Iran. And that is actually an opinion, a very strong opinion, in Israel and in their supporters in the West. Now, in those conditions, if I was the Iranian General Staff or Salami, who's the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, I would be saying to the elected political leadership, maybe we do need nuclear weapons, because that's the only way we're going to stop them from being nuking us. And now, I'm not necessarily in favour of that, because Ayatollah Khomeini said years ago, we don't need nuclear weapons. They're not Islamic. We don't want them. Because if they nuke us, it'll be their shame and not ours. Yeah. And but of course, we will actually destroy them without nuclear weapons. If we come to a fight now between Israel and Iran, it's going to be very interesting. Because the Iranians have not, in fact, used even a fraction of what they're capable of chucking at the Israelis. And even with now being able to overfly Syria so they can get closer to Iran without having to go around the houses, they will find that when the Iranians fire back with their top flight hypersonic missiles, which the Russians have got, the Iranians have got, but NATO hasn't got, all these forces that are now surrounding Gaza, for example, they're all bunched up. If they're in the Ukraine, they'd all be dead already. And of course, if the war starts, they're going to have to disperse, and if they don't disperse, the Iranians are going to kill loads and loads and loads of Israeli soldiers. And I shall be cheering, because I'm not a pacifist, Tony. Are you?
Well, yes, I am, actually. I'm a pacifist.
Not.
Yeah, okay.
Well, everybody's got their views, haven't
they? We're a bit different on that one particular one. Anyway, well, as a pacifist, I'm not sure. I'm very conflicted about whether we should listen to what David Miller said on the Stu Peters show, him being a far right white supremacist. Do you think we should have a listen or not?
We might as well. Listen, if you've got it to listen to, this is freedom of speech, isn't it? I'll debate with any white supremacist. I'll say you're a racist, mate.
The fact that Israeli government, which is funded by America, by the American taxpayer, by you, is sending its agents to the United States for malign purposes. And the odds are that this is just one of dozens, if not hundreds, of programs exactly like it in America and England and other places as well. So for more on all of this, we're now joined again by David Miller. So right out in the wide open, David, they're just showing us, yep, we have these agents here that are meant to pull off a psyop on the American people. And the American people are funding this psyop so they can just believe more of this nonsense.
Well, that's right. You said dozens and dozens across the world, but there's dozens and dozens in the US itself. This is only one of a number of other similar operations. And in fact, the network which I have revealed here, the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement, is a network which is itself 850 separate organizations all around the world, many of them in the US, most of them in the US, but all around the world. And this is an attempt to subvert the politics of the US. You said that the money goes from the US to Israel and it comes back via these organizations. Well, that's true. But what you're also seeing, of course, is that the money comes back in a disguised way. It goes via this thing called Voices of Israel. It used to be called Consort. And it's a deniable company which is set up as a public benefit company on behalf of the Israeli government. And the reason that they've done that they've sent the money through Voices of Israel, is so that it can evade the law in the US. If it didn't go through Voices of Israel, all of the organizations which took the money would have to register as foreign agents under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which, as you, of course, you'll know, was set up in 1938 to combat Nazi money influencing US politics. So you've got a bizarre situation here where there are hundreds and hundreds of organizations being marshaled by this particular operation, and that their aim is simply to subvert the possibility that Americans could take sensible decisions on foreign policy and indeed on some domestic policies. What we see is that there's been a 50-year campaign by the Zionist movement, and in particular led by AIPAC and its previous incarnations, to evade the Foreign Agents Registration Act, and they've done that quite successfully. There are some elements of the Israeli government who register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, but there are others which don't. I mean, the AIPAC is one, but there's another one called the Jewish National Fund, which is engaged in sending money to steal land from the Palestinians in occupied Palestine. It fought a long battle to be against registration. It's not registered. In Canada, just the other day, I noticed that the courts took a decision that the Jewish National Fund in Canada has to be closed down, because not only was it sending money to steal Palestinians' homes and land, it was also secretly sending money directly to the occupation forces, the IDF. So what we're seeing here is that this is not just that they're evading the law, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, but they're actually directly engaged in the genocide in Palestine.
This is really important, the stuff that Dave is pointing out here. This thing called the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement is actually, which he mentions there, is an umbrella group for what looks like hundreds of bodies of various sorts that are doing things like funding the IDF and yet posing under charitable status here or as foundations in the United States.
Yes, and something like the Charity Commission needs to look into this. I mean, people have been raising money for the Israeli Defense Forces as a charity. The Israeli Defense Forces are genocidal murderers. You can't raise money for them as a charity. If we were raising money for Hamas or Hezbollah, then we would be prosecuted. But they can raise money for their terrorists, and they don't get prosecuted. They get a pat on the back. Now, the double standards here are absolutely clear to the dogs in the street in countries like Colombia, for example. Mentioned Colombia earlier on. I went to Colombia in 2005. The Colombian paramilitaries, supported by Israeli officers, armed with Galil rifles, killed thousands of social movement activists in Colombia. So there's lots of reasons for people in Latin America to hate the Israelis' guts, because they're not just killing Palestinians, they've been killing us, which is why Gustavo Petro, who is the elected left-wing president of Colombia, has cut off there's no diplomatic relations with Israel now, and they've stopped them getting any coal coming in from Colombia. But of course,
I wonder, because we were hearing earlier about Colombia mercenaries, weren't we?
Because the Colombian paramilitaries, the AUC, Auto Unidas Defensas de Colombia, was set up with the help of Israeli Mossad officers. And it was Ralph Etienne who went there, and he said, what you need to do is you need to set up paramilitary groups which will kill the social movement leaders and the guerrillas that you hate. And they did. They killed thousands of people. And there's plenty of people in Colombia who've got reason to hate the Israeli armed forces, because what they did in Colombia, not what they've done in Palestine. And they've been all over the world, just like the British. We stick our finger into all sorts of pies, Tony, in Ukraine and in Syria and in Libya and Iraq. And so, we're only a small country, but we get around.
Interesting that various Jewish people, including here George Rosenberg on Twitter, is saying, thank you, Jewish Chronicle, for drawing attention to David Miller's call for funds. I have donated. So what they're doing is they're saying, oh, look, ha, 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 David Miller, the Bristol University are campaigning against him. But a sizable proportion of the Jewish readers of the Jewish Chronicle are taking that as, ah, right, well, we'll support him then. And in fact, his fighting fund is doing very well.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. I think the point about this, I mentioned earlier the Filton 20 or whatever it is, the young, mainly young people who broke into the Elbit Systems factory up there in Filton in Bristol. They're holding them. They're not going to put them on trial at the Old Bailey till next November. So they're all being held in prison. They could be released, and you know, there's no particular reason. I mean, they're mostly being charged with criminal damage, although some people have been charged with grievous bodily harm. But the point is that they're keeping them in prison, but they're not allowed to associate with each other. Because, of course, that's, as we all know, prisons are the universities of revolution. And, of course, if they were all in the same prison, they could be having lots of political discussions and all the rest of it. So they've separated them out. So they're all in different prisons in different parts of the country so that they can't talk to each other. But we're going to hold you till next November before you go to trial. Because when it comes to trial, when they get in front of a jury at the Old Bailey, they will get off, and they know they will. And this is the issue for the state. It's a game of cat and mouse. You can put us in prison, just like the suffragettes, and we will actually gain from that. So, in other words, it's bring it on. And I'm sure David Miller relishes the fight. Good for him.
Rafi Berg is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to BBC pro-Israel bias. This is kind of kicked off over the holidays. Rafi Berg, his job is to water down. Public attention focused on Berg after the journalist Owen Jones published an investigation in December about pro-Israel bias at the BBC. Having interviewed journalists and other staff at the public broadcaster, Jones revealed that senior figures had been skewing coverage to be more favourable to Israel while dismissing regular objections from employees who demanded the corporation uphold its commitment to providing fair and impartial reporting. One said this guy's entire job is to water down everything that's critical of Israel. Others said he micromanages coverage, with one insisting that he has the power to reframe every story. Even worse are his connections to the CIA, Mossad, and war criminal Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So this guy, Rafi Berg, he's the Middle East editor, Martin, yet he's expressed great congratulations for people, organisations like the Mossad and the CIA.
Well, he used to work for them, I believe. So he's not just a friend of theirs. He was on the payroll.
How did he manage to become a Middle East editor of the BBC?
Well, you may well ask, Tony. You may well ask.
Well, I'll tell you why. I'll tell you how. Sorry, not why, but how. That is through his boss, who is quite obviously the BBC's head of news. And a lovely lady called Tamara Aboud has put up a petition. So I'll put a link up to David Miller's appeal, and also this petition, sack the BBC's head of news. It says, I'm a former commissioning editor at News and Current Affairs at Channel 4. I've first-hand experience of the malign influence the Zionist lobby groups exert over programme makers. I spent the last 15 months watching in disgust as mainstream broadcasters have framed what's happening in Gaza through the lens of Israeli propagandists. Observable fact, she says. Numerous reports are emerging of this bias and deliberate failure to report the reality. She said, yesterday I read of concerns building over the flagrant bias of Rafi Berg, BBC's Middle East online editor. I know from former colleagues still in TV, he's known to kill commissions that are critical of Israel or sympathetic to Palestinians. No pun intended, but Rafi is the tip of the iceberg. And she, what she does is, I won't read the whole thing out here, but she goes down to explain that Deborah Turnis is the chief executive of BBC News. This is happening on her watch. She would be involved in his appointment. And your licence fee pays her £400,000 plus salary. Deborah Turnis Musk. I'd not heard of Deborah Turnis, but she's head of BBC News, apparently, chief executive. Although they shouldn't really, in a public company, be calling anyone a chief executive. That's a private business. Like the Murdoch Empire, the BBC must commit to rooting out all its Zionists, from Robbie Gibb, who sits on the BBC's Editorial Standards Committee and links to the discredited Jewish Chronicle, to Rafi Berg, whose dangerous bias is now being exposed by a number of sources.
Well, interestingly enough, there's a demonstration tomorrow about the genocide in Gaza in London, which was going to assemble in Portland Place outside the BBC. The Metropolitan Police have informed the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and the other organisers that they can't assemble there because apparently there is a synagogue around the corner. And they have complained that that they're going to be going to the synagogue on that Saturday, and therefore they don't want this demonstration to take place. And of course, it's outside the BBC because of these revelations. But the Metropolitan Police have caved to pressure from the Zionist lobby, and apparently they're not going to be allowed to assemble outside the BBC. I imagine there are negotiations going on as we speak between PSC and the Metropolitan Police about what is going to happen about this. But of course, it may well be that people are going to turn up anyway, because that can happen as well.
The Met said it had reflected on the views of the local community and business representatives, including congregation members at a synagogue at a very short distance from the proposed rally before reaching its decision. So the BBC is being protected by an accidental synagogue at the BBC. Maybe there are quite a few Jewish people that are at the BBC that go to that synagogue.
Well, I don't know, but I think, just because you happen to have a synagogue or a mosque or a church nearby, does that mean that people can't assemble for a peaceful demonstration? What's the logic? There's not been any violence at all on any of these demonstrations. Nobody has attacked anybody. Loads of Jewish people have spoken out and said this is wrong, wrong, wrong. As Jews, we're going to be on that demonstration. Now, that doesn't mean that we, you know...
Are they not allowed to go outside their synagogue?
Well, I mean, the point is that just because there is a synagogue there doesn't mean you can't have a demonstration. I mean, there are loads of churches in the middle of Bristol. I mean, are we allowed to assemble outside those churches?
Tamara Aboud, from ex-Channel 4 news person, News and Current Affairs Commissioning Editor, what she's saying is, and well done to her, you know, she's saying actually this is part of the lobby. This is part of the home front of the genocide.
It is, and this is going to get to be very, very hot as we go forward. I, for one, and I know many of my friends and colleagues and people like in this room, we are not going to walk by on the other side of the road as you put these people down. We're not going to do that. It's not in our nature, and we are going to make you pay the price.
So just before the break, final item, an old mate of mine called Johnny Walker, he died over the Christmas period. I think it was on the last day of the year, because I worked on his programme for a year in central London at Marylebone High Street, which was just around about 10 minutes, maybe 7 minutes walk from Broadcasting House, because when doing research for documentaries, I used to have to go to News Information and the Reference Library at Broadcasting House, which was a fantastic facility. Loads of these little press cuttings and things like that, which you could use for making good documentaries, which we used to put out on GLR. And what a fantastic station we were. And we knew we were because we had more and more people all the time listening to us. I have no idea why Matthew Bannister was told by the higher ups at the BBC to get rid of the station, but Johnny was extremely good guy to work with. He was he'd always give him some difficult stories. He wasn't really just a DJ, as you can probably hear from here, where he talks a little bit about. So what we're going to hear now is a little bit about his near-death experience, as well as his starting in pirate radio, and maybe that's why this show sounds a little bit like pirate radio.
Paul McCartney in Wings, and that's Jed, opening up this edition of Johnny Walker's Sounds of the 70s. A very good afternoon. Now, today of the next couple of hours...
An internet radio station, I've been thinking about it for quite a long time. It's one of those things, you think about it and you think, yeah, that's a neat idea. But I've suddenly had a concept of how I can update the pirate thing. I was on the ships in the 1960s as a pirate disc jockey. And I like the pirate thing in terms of it's a bit anarchic, it's a bit edgy. It implies sort of anarchy, and it's not controlled.
I've always felt one of the most important things that I could do is to try and communicate and to get over my unshakable belief that death is not the end. After my illness and the chemotherapy caused my intestines to burst open, I had an emergency operation, and the anaesthetist said I lost him 3 times, but each time he came back. Subsequently, I was told by a psychic, she said, when you were on the operating table, you were gone. You were in what I would call the anteroom of the spirit world. And she said a blocking party went to meet you and said, we will give you some soul knowledge, and we want you to go back and do a mission. I obviously had agreed, because I'm still here. But I don't know what that mission is.
Johnny, it's so typical. I don't know what the mission is. Yeah, he used to strut into the production office at Marylebone High Street and smoking, puffing away on his Marlboro lights. a very, you know, it was a non-smoking newsroom. And and then around about, I think his show used to finish at 3, not absolutely sure, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then you'd hear him rev up his Harley Davidson motorbike, which was parked just out the back. You could hear it through the whole production office, and then he'd roar off into the rest of the day. So anyway, he's roared off into the night now forever. Good old Johnny Walker, fantastic guy, and a brilliant bloke to work with at what was a fantastic station, where they had a really good young in fact, Chris Morris, who we're going to be hearing from a bit in a minute, he was also on that station with me many years ago, back around about 1989-1990.
Dominique et Nick s'en allaient tout simplement au Dieu, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. À l'époque où Jean Santerre d'Angleterre était le roi, Dominique, notre père, combattit les Albigeois. Dominique, Nick, Nick s'en allait tout simplement, routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Certains jours, un hérétique par des ronces le conduit, mais notre père Dominique, par sa joie, le convertit. Dominique, Nick, Nick s'en allait tout simplement, routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Ni chameau, ni diligence, il parcourt l'Europe à pied, Scandinavie ou Provence, dans la sainte pauvreté. Dominique, Nick, Nick s'en allait tout simplement, routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Enflamma de toute école, fils et garçons pleins d'ardeur, et pour semer la parole, inventa les frères prêcheurs. Dominique, Nick, Nick s'en allait tout simplement, routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Chez Dominique et ses frères, le pain s'en vint à manquer, et deux anges se présentèrent portant de grands pains dorés. Dominique, Nick, Nick s'en allait tout simplement, routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Dominique vit en rêve les prêcheurs du monde entier, sous le manteau de la Vierge en grand nombre rassemblés. Dominique, Nick, Nick s'en allait tout simplement, routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Dominique, mon bon père, garde-nous simples et gais, pour annoncer à nos frères la vie et la vérité. Dominique, Nick, Nick s'en allait tout simplement, routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu.
The summer sun is fading as the year grows old, and darker days are drawing near. The winter winds will be much colder now you're not here. I'll watch the birds fly south across the autumn sky, and one by one they disappear. I wish that I was flying with them. Now you're not here. Like the song through the trees, you came to love me. Britain's golden gown, we used to kick our way. You always love this time of year. Those fall leaves lie undisturbed now, 'cause you're not here. Gentle rain falls softly on my weary eyes, as if to hide a lonely tear. My life will be forever autumn, 'cause you're not here.
So that's John Lydon, and left field from 1993 with Open Up. Obviously, you would have noticed the link to the news stories coming out constantly, incessantly from California over the last, gosh, it was almost like a week or something, isn't it? Before that, it was a kind of partly an apology. Justin Hayward on Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds and the song Forever Autumn, because I played terribly, because I was in a real rush before Christmas. I put the version of Forever Autumn, which is from the War of the Worlds album, which is awful, really, compared to the single. They did a really nice, polished, much up-produced version for the single in 1978. So there you got, I put that on the end of the last show we did before Christmas. So there is the proper version of Forever Autumn from 1978 with Justin Hayward. And before that, you heard the singing nun, Sister Smile. And that is the song called Dominique from 1963. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with the gurgling sink in the background for some reason. I don't know why that's coming through. If you could hear that, with Irish Republican and Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So for me, the bizarre thing, looking at John Lydon there, listening to John Lydon and Left Field, is the story's all about the horrors of California, but not Gaza at the moment, isn't it?
Well, that's the way the international news media works, isn't it? I mean, Gaza's so last year, Tony. It's nothing happening there now. And, of course, we've had the revolution in Syria. That's much more interesting. And, the football season's in full swing. And, we're all moving on.
And as we're hearing today, their arsonists have been arrested, and the police have been keeping this quiet because they want to arrest the other arsonists. It is even possible that several of the, because there's something like seven fires raging, that one arsonist might have set several of the fires. And of course, this does challenge the climate agenda. So if you're going to, if you're a top BBC news person, such as Deborah Turnis, and you're given an opportunity, or Raffi Berg, and you're given an opportunity to talk about Gaza and the genocide going on there, and climate, and the fires in California, we know which one you're going to choose.
We do, yes. I mean, the way the mainstream news media works is it's prop agenda, isn't it? So, in other words, this is the sort of thing that you ought to be worried about. And, you know, this stuff over here, don't take any notice of it. And incidentally, of course, the Americans this week, the American government, you know, the Biden administration, has accused the RSF in Sudan of carrying out genocide, because they've been deliberately attacking civilian targets. And strangely enough, the US has just sold the United Arab Emirates masses of weaponry, which they're then supplying to their protégés, the RSF, in Sudan, to kill people. So they've accused the RSF of genocide, even though the Americans are supplying the weaponry to them. But we can't accuse the Israelis of genocide, because obviously that would be anti-Semitic.
No, it's not been scripted in to the global media show. The reason I say that is, for me, the big story over the break has been ex-Israeli agents revealing how pager attacks were carried out. This is by Raffi Berg, BBC News, obviously very close to the Mossad, rather chummy with them. Two former Israeli intelligence agents have revealed how members of the Lebanese Shia militia group, political party, sorry, you've written that wrong, Mr. Raffi Berg, Hezbollah, used Israeli-made walkie-talkies booby-trapped with explosives for 10 years before they were detonated in a surprise attack in September. Two ex-Mossad agents told CBS News, not him, obviously, for some reason, maybe he's trying to just put that up as a kind of cover story for the fact that he's so close to the Mossad, was duped into buying thousands of rigged walkie-talkies and pagers without realising they were made in Israel. But the extraordinary thing in the interview with CBS that these guys say, he's given the name Michael, said Mossad had concealed the explosive device inside the batteries operating the walkie-talkies. and would typically be carried in a vest near the wearer's heart. That's nice, isn't it? He said they bought 16,000 of them. He said, we've got an incredible array of possibilities for creating foreign companies that have no way of being traced back to Israel. Shell companies. This sounds a little bit mafia, doesn't it? Is this the Israeli mafia?
Well, I mean, what they're doing there is in actual fact telling us what they did, and this is a criminal offence under Lebanese law. So everybody's saying all of this.
And it's actually under a war crime as well.
Yes, it's
under international law.
So, that's
because
right.
There were 4 children were killed.
That's right.
Loads of people who were also killed who had nothing to do with Hezbollah.
Well, in any case, Hezbollah, the people who were using the pages were not the military wing of Hezbollah. It was the first responders and the social workers and other people who run their social programs.
He said, we create a pretend world. We are a global production company. We write the screenplay. We're the directors. We're the producers. We're the main actors. And the world is our stage. That's what the Mossad agents
say. That's right. Through deception, by way of deception to make war.
Obviously.
Believe everything we say.
One of the most important parts of that script is the guy that's written this article, Rafi Berg himself.
Well, indeed. I mean,
so they've gone basically from what's happened is they've been making films about this sort of thing. They've also been employing these methods in the battlefield, and now they're turning them into news stories.
Yeah, well, what they do is what many criminals do. They actually boast about their criminal behaviour, and of course, ultimately, that is going to count against them. And it's already counting against them because most people in the world have worked out that the Israelis are lying, two-faced murderers. Certainly, the government, and of course, the lies about the Ukraine that the Western media have been saying that the Zelensky's winning, although he's not the president anymore because there wasn't an election in May that should have been, and the lie. Most people are beginning to realise that we're being bombarded continuously by deep state propaganda, and of course, one of the good things about Trump and Liz Truss, if you like, is that everybody knows that there is such a thing as the deep state. When we were talking about 7/7 earlier, if we'd mentioned the deep state, they'd say, tinfoil hat. Now everybody knows there's a deep state. The deep state is deeply involved in genocide, and many of them live in this little isle of ours, and they live not far away from us, and they are murderers.
And that Coast guy has been writing about the grooming scandal, as well as many other things, like, for example, the implication of the British support for the genocide, and he had this to say.
Our authorities don't care. They place no value on the lives of individual children is, I say again, in my opinion, the least of it. It's been plain to see for decades or longer this disregard for human life, family life, children's lives. And as far as I'm concerned, it's the ultimate expression of the reality of the anti-human, anti-life agenda that threatens every aspect of our society. So-called conspiracy theorists refer more and more to death cults, to Satanism, and I for one no longer doubt them. It has not been natural or organic, this diminishing of the value of life and of children's lives. I say that on the contrary, it has been deliberate and calculated. Right now, there's appropriate rage about the revelations of child rape in English towns on a horrific scale over many decades and carried out by gangs of predominantly Pakistani men. The rage and revulsion and demands for justice and retribution are right and proper. That the authorities, steered by governments of whatever political persuasion, turned blind eyes at best, or worse by far, covered up the horror, is no longer even denied. But among the most important questions in relation to the apparent bursting of the dam that held back the truth for so long is, why now? Why is this particular meat being thrown to the pack now, after all this time? I say the answer must lead to the realisation, however hard and uncomfortable, that there is a real and dreadful darkness at the heart of things. That darkness has seen the deliberate diminishing and devaluing of human life, and especially of the lives of children. That darkness is motivated to act by one thing and one thing only, and that's expediency. No one can any longer deny the rapes in unthinkable numbers often involving the monstrous repeated rape of the same individuals over and over again for months and years, sadistic and utterly obscene. The resultant rage is righteous, no argument. But why all the heat now? Brave souls, victims and whistleblowers were trying to stop the rape gangs from the 1970s onwards. Always the official reaction was to silence and smear, if not to criminalise, those sounding the alarm. Now the whole appalling story has been blown wide open.
So, yeah, great question. Why now, Martin? What do you think?
Because
Elon Musk intervening, particularly.
It's because there is an attempt by the Israeli deep state to demonise Muslims. Now, I'm not saying that Muslims weren't involved in these crimes. They clearly were. But, of course, there was a Muslim prosecutor from the northwest of England. I think it's Nafiz Ali, I think his name was. And he was, you know, he was a public prosecutor. And he's saying, well, I've prosecuted lots of paedophilic gangs. But when they're Muslim gangs, they're called grooming gangs. When they're white, we call them paedophile circles. In other words, it's
a... Yeah, or child prostitution.
Child prostitution and all the rest. And in actual fact, of course, this is a deliberate attempt by why now this minute? Because Tommy Robinson has been picked up by Musk as a political prisoner. Now he's in contempt of what he was doing at the trial of people who were put on trial for this. He was turning up, and he was actually, by doing what he was doing, was making it possible for the defence lawyers to argue that it wasn't a fair trial because he was prejudicing the jury.
He made a film, I believe, about one of the people who was supposedly involved, which was inaccurate. Anyway, you're not allowed to do that during a trial.
No,
so
you're
he's
not.
been put away.
No, but
actually, as the guy from Extinction Rebellion has also been put away for contempt of court. So the idea is, if you're not going to go along with the court process, and if you're going to actually try and disrupt the court process by trying to influence a jury directly from outside the court, then you're going to jail, and that's why he's there.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, he's not in jail for that. He's actually in jail for another offence, because he made a film about a Syrian refugee boy who supposedly had raped a white girl. And it turned out this was absolutely wrong. There was no evidence for this whatsoever. The boy himself, the boy that he'd picked on, got beaten up and all sorts of things. But his lawyer sued Tommy Robinson to say that's defamation of character, because there's no evidence that this boy had done any such thing. And of course, what happened was they won that court case, and then he made a film about it, and then he showed the film in his big protest that he had in Trafalgar Square just before the kickoff in Southport, and then that was the reason why he then fled to Iron Napier, and when he came back to Britain, he's arrested, and he's again contempt of court, because what he's doing is deliberately stirring up racial hatred.
Yeah, so do you
that
think
is what he's doing.
So what's Musk up to? The same?
Yes.
By supporting Tommy, isn't he?
Yes, and he's not even, you know, he goes on about, he's now what, the richest man in the world, and he's a paid member of the US government.
How does this relate to Israel?
Because
it does, doesn't it?
Of course it does, because the whole point about Tommy Robinson and the whole right wing in the West being pushed towards Islamophobia rather than anti-Semitism, because of course traditionally the right wing are anti-Semitic rather than Islamophobic, and of course Tommy Robinson has been to the occupied Golan Heights. There's a picture of him holding a Galil rifle on the top of it, and he's going about, yes, the Israelis are justified because the Muslims are the enemy. The Muslims are the enemy of humanity. Blah 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 blah. Now that is actually incredibly dangerous. Now the other thing that's of course going on, because we have quite a big Pakistani community in Bristol, we know very well about what's happened with Imran Khan, the most popular politician in Pakistan, who still rots in a prison kept there by the West. And the people here know. And of course, lots of people from Pakistan around here, you will know who I'm talking about, Tony, they know very well about what we're talking about 7-7, 9-11, and all the rest of it. And of course, most people have probably forgotten or did not know that General Gul, who used to head of the ISI in Pakistan, came out straight after 9-11 and said the Americans did this. He's a senior general in Pakistan.
So what Elon Musk is weighing in on, really, is just more Islamophobia. This is part of the home front. But anyway, of course, there is a genuine issue about these grooming gangs.
Absolutely.
And Keir Starmer, Prime Minister, responded to Elon Musk.
child sexual exploitation is utterly sickening. Utterly sickening. And for many, many years, too many victims have been completely let down. Let down by perverse ideas about community relations, or by the idea that institutions must be protected above all else. And they've not been listened to, and they've not been heard. And when I was chief prosecutor for 5 years, I tackled that head on, because I could see what was happening. And that's why I reopened cases that had been closed and supposedly finished. I brought the first major prosecution of an Asian grooming gang. In the particular case, it was in Rochdale, but it was the first of its kind. There were many that then followed that format. I changed the whole prosecution approach because I wanted to challenge and did challenge the myths and stereotypes that were stopping those victims being heard. So we changed the entire approach, not without criticism at the time, I might add. And when I left office, we had the highest number of child sexual abuse cases being prosecuted on record. Now, that record is not secret. As a public servant, it's there for all of you or everybody to see.
Actually, fact of the matter is, lots of records at the Crown Prosecution Service have been destroyed, even though they shouldn't have been destroyed, those particularly relating to Julian Assange. And there is an ongoing attempt by Assange's family to get those somehow, I don't know if they exist or they're covered by freedom of information or what, but to reveal the role that Starmer played in prosecuting Julian Assange. But the fact is that Starmer coming out with this reaction to Elon Musk has brought quite a lot of people who were involved campaigning for proper inquiries into grooming and child prostitution, one of whom is former Manchester Police Detective Maggie Oliver.
Former Detective Constable Greater Manchester Police in Rochdale, whistleblower Maggie Oliver. Morning, Maggie. It's always lovely to see you.
Good morning, I hear
Sammy talk like that, I get goosebumps, because it's remarkable for a woman to have been through something so traumatic to come out so articulate, so determined, so tenacious. Is she typical, Sammy, of the girls that have suffered, or a lot of them quietly away in the background?
Yeah, many. I mean, every word that Sammy said there is true. That's the first thing to say. And for decades, there's been a reluctance or a failure to listen to the voices of the victims and the survivors. They have been blamed, they have been criminalised, they have been judged, they have been failed by all the public institutions that are meant to protect them. Finally, again, we are looking at this problem in detail. It's a shame that the reason that we've had this movement the last few days is because Elon Musk happened to write about it on Twitter. And now suddenly, last night, we've got Yvette Cooper announcing that they're going to implement just 3 at the moment of the 20 recommendations from the National Abuse Inquiry led by Alexis Shea, of which I was a part. I'd say it's painfully slow, too little, too late. Are they really going to happen? I don't know.
So Alexis Jay's inquiry, this was quite a lot of the survivors discredited it, said it was no good what she was doing, even though we've only seen 3 of the proposals that she said must be implemented after that inquiry, implemented out of 20, which isn't very good. I mean, why can't they just get on and implement this thing? But then there is also this other point, Martin, which is that many feel that inquiry just wasn't adequate. It didn't look at the structural problems. It was run by the Home Office. Many of the structures that had facilitated child prostitution, paedophilia and grooming were in the Home Office itself, which manages the police.
Well, of course, you know, we're not talking, I'm not trying to belittle what's going on here, but nobody's mentioning the King Cora Boys Home scandal from the 1970s, where MI5 were prostituting young boys to loyalist paramilitaries in order to blackmail them. Nobody's ever been punished for any of that, Tony. Strangely. And Jimmy Savile was allowed to carry on doing what he was doing because he was embedded in these elite paedophile networks. And of course, both Elon Musk and Donald Trump probably were on the Lolita Express with Jeffrey Epstein, weren't they? Which is why they're in power now. And that's what's going on behind the scenes. And I'm not saying for one moment that we should belittle any sexual exploitation of anybody. It's no good, is it? Many of these girls that are the victims, of course, are the kind of people, you know, they've come out of care, they haven't got anybody to look after them. Over 100 children under 16 in this country are killed every year by their carers.
Anyway, safeguarding Minister Jess Phillips, who's the one who has been targeted in various of these newspaper articles here in Britain, which were then picked up by Elon Musk, because there was another inquiry which was slated to start later this year, which she cancelled, and she was asked about this intervention by Musk as well this week.
What would you like to say?
I suppose the thing that my strongest feeling is that there is a huge furore about something a man thousands of miles away said about me that has led to an issue that I care so deeply about and have dedicated most of my working life and quite a lot of my personal life to making better and supporting victims, specifically of grooming gangs, really, really directly. And it's painful to watch it become a political football rather than an actual attempt to really do something. You get very, very tired when you do this kind of work, and I've sat in courtrooms with young girls because they'll only speak if I'm sat there holding their hand. I've literally had a young woman groomed and raped, and she was pregnant, miscarry to the point where it marked my shoes because I was in the room with her and taking her to hospital while that was happening.
So that's Jess Phillips there. I'll put the full version of these up on our show page. But, Marty, she doesn't sound like a very professional person there at all. She's just talking about, yeah, well, I've personally been involved in it. But what she's done is she's killed this inquiry, which could have actually got deeper into this whole topic, not just of the grooming gangs, but also child prostitution systemic, much more generally, and the problem that there's been over decades of the police not being able to prosecute this for one reason or another. Even though obviously there are some detectives that want to do the prosecutions, finding the Home Office unsupportive and senior police unsupportive.
Well, what can I say? She is I believe that the British police force are looking into Musk accused Jess Phillips of, because of course she's now received a torrent of abusive emails and social media. So she's being targeted, as is Starmer being targeted. I mean, Musk has openly called for Starmer to be overthrown.
He said that Jess Phillips should be in jail.
Well, indeed, I think Elon Musk should be in jail.
Or maybe, I thought you believed in free speech.
I believe in free speech, but of course, if you did, he shouldn't be in jail for what he says, but for what he does. Okay? So let's look deeper into all of this. Yeah, these people that are pushing this agenda now from the deep state in the US, because that's what they are. Really,
the thing is, it is a genuine problem.
But of course, but don't forget what Starmer said in Prime Minister's Questions this week when Kemi Badenoch brought it up. He said, "You've been in power. You were in power for 14 years. You've been 7 years in, and you didn't at any stage even mention this. And suddenly Musk mentions it, and they're all falling over themselves to say, we need an inquiry. You were in power. You could have had an inquiry, but you chose not to have one. Why was that?
Well,
then?
Actually, they did have a inquiry, but not this one. Yeah. It just seems to be very strange that Jess Phillips has decided no, even though she's safeguarding minister, they're not going to be able to continue the inquiry process. But anyway, let's have it. Yes, but that's the fact is there are Let's have a listen to what some of the actual survivors say. I mean, I don't know if you were listening to the Manchester cop. She was saying that there needs to be one.
Okay.
And we're going to hear from many police and survivors now. Another survivor, actually, who she just took to Twitter to say what she thought about Elon Musk's, about Keir Starmer's reaction to it all.
I just feel so angry as I've just watched the Keir Starmer, where he's been asked a question about what's been going on. And I'm not sure if this man is just an absolute retard or if he does this deliberately, because he is so disrespectful, it's beyond belief. And not just with his comment, you know, I've been really angry with him about how he dealt with in South Park when children, you know, it was a massacre. You know, people got a stabbing. No, it wasn't. He's branding people again as far right. This is not being far right. This is people, and not just only in our country but around the world, having genuine concerns and outrage of what's happened, and very rightly so. Now let's be very clear on what we're talking about, what's been happening. We are talking about children being groomed, abused, raped, tortured, trafficked, murdered, blamed, ignored, impregnated, criminalized. And this isn't just from, you know, your gangs from the streets. We know, because evidence has shown us, and people like me have been exposing it, that politicians were involved. And I'd like to remind Keir Starmer that those politicians that I've named are Labour politicians.
So that's her name is Sammy Woodhouse, and she, rather than do media interviews, she just decided to go on to Twitter to talk about that. She's a survivor of abuse. The main problem, it seems to me, is that the inquiry is finished. A lot of the participants say it's not adequate, but even if it was adequate, it's not been implemented. So you've got 17 out of 20 of the recommendations ignored by both Conservative and Labour. And I don't think most of the survivors are trying to make any kind of political points. They just want to get to the bottom of this, and they want to get the people who've been covering it up in jail. And also those who have been doing the organised abuse. Anyway, this week I also spoke to John Wedges, a former London police detective working on child prostitution for many years. And he really, I think, explains very well that this is nothing to do really with just grooming. It's a systemic problem right across the country. And very little attention is paid to London, which is where much of this goes on.
London is one of the biggest capital cities in the Western world. It is the most diverse city with the oldest police force in the world. And there was no dedicated unit to look at kids from the care system, because I only dealt with kids from the care system, who were being pimped out, as it were. So it started off with one girl, a little 14-year-old girl, making an allegation. She was being picked up from kids' home and trafficked out to all sorts of clients. Went to another. I think the end, I need to clarify it with the ICSA evidence, but I think it ended up with 36 children in a very short period of time. It got reduced when it went to committal at the Crown Court to 2 children. And unfortunately, in the following months, maybe year, both of the children ended up dead in suspicious circumstances.
Wow. Well, look, how did you get from this one report up to so many kids and then back down to 2 again?
Well, let's make it straight. The police's intention at the time was to silence this one girl, because she continually kept making allegations that she was being pimped out, and the police kept telling her to shut up. So she ended up in a care home.
What part of London is this? Can you go into
central? This was Westminster, central London. So the little girl.
So they were trying to shut her up. The police were.
Because I was on a specialist unit which dealt with sexual offences against children for commercial gain. So prostitution, pimping, that sort of thing. But it was only as a by-the-way. It was mainly prostitutes we were dealing with. But under the Street Offences Act, which covers prostitutes, street prostitutes, it also has a child protection element in there. So there was no real, at the time, no real dedicated unit. There was no dedicated unit set up until the police were exposed by the Savile Inquiry for their lacklustre approach to this sort of heinous crime. Now, this girl had made allegations that a woman who was known to the vice unit, a known common prostitute, was pimping her and other girls out. And the police knew about it. So I was told, go and see her and shut her up. We know she's a liar. So that was my briefing before I was deployed to go and meet with this little girl. I listened to her and I believed her. And she said to me, it's not just me, John, there's others. So she gave me the name of another girl. I went to visit that girl. That girl was even younger and smaller than her. And she said exactly the same. And we have this MO, now what they call it grooming gangs. You see it splattered everywhere. Look, no one's reinventing the wheel here. This has been going on probably since the inception of the police, and definitely the cover-up has. Now, they take advantage of girls and boys, because bear in mind, we dealt with girls and boys in our inquiry. I know that you had the Rochdale scandal with three girls. We are 36. And in a subsequent inquiry I did, in a week, we found 50. So in all, I've dealt with nearly 100 kids that were being groomed, pimped out, whatever you want to call it, within London. And, you know, it was expanding by the minute. So they take kids, usually that were in care or under care orders with absent parents or drug-addicted parents, and it was a prostitute that would pick them up, and she would deliver them to various venues for the purpose of prostitution. So the venues would include, in the morning, they were taken to crack houses. So can you imagine a crack house, if anyone's ever been in one of these? These are disgusting venues. And they are also dangerous venues, because with crack cocaine and the serving up, the dealing of it, you get serious and organised criminality, firearms possession, you get drug addicts visiting, you get a lot of sexually and airborne transmitted diseases. So we don't just go on about hepatitis, A, B, C, AIDS, HIV, we're on about contagious tuberculosis. You know, these antiquated diseases, which are really common amongst the vagrant community and a drug addicted community. And these little girls were harbouring these life-threatening diseases. They were all on crack cocaine and heroin. They were swapped around in crack houses in exchange for a rocks of crack. The guys doing it were Jamaican guys. The woman taken there was English, right? They were then taken to hotels, and they were passed out, sold out by the hour in cheap budget hotels for builders who visit in London for transient trade. So you get a lot of builders coming from the north, from Ireland, and they would get cheap hotel accommodation in the Paddington area, just around the corner from Paddington Station. That's where they would reside. And the hoteliers, when they went off duty in the evening, the night duty staff would make a room available for these guys, for the prostitute who was pimping the girls out, to take these little kids, so these builders, British guys, whatever they were, to have sex with these little girls, which were clearly underage. And so bear in mind,
how old?
What the age group I dealt with was from 9 to 14. 9 was the youngest. A lot of them were underweight because of their lifestyle and their class A drug addiction. But in the late evening, early hours of the morning, the girls were then taken to upmarket Mayfair Arab restaurants, where they traded out amongst the Arab clientele for £2,000 apiece. So we had a whole demographic of London society involved in you know, the abuse and the procurement of these kids for prostitution. And the police had known about it for 15 years prior, There was not one dedicated officer, and they had actively covered this criminality up, because as I was to find out, the kids would tell me about some of the clients, and that involved a police officer that operated out of Paddington Police Station. That was later corroborated by a senior detective that dealt with sexual abuse. She corroborated that earlier last year, because she had prostitutes coming to her that said that at the same time I was dealing with the kids, these women are now a lot older, were saying that they were being picked up from care homes and pimped out in the same area, in the same gang, as it were. And one of the guys that was organising it was a police officer, which was the same information I had all them years ago from Paddington Police Station. And that was the information...
The same name of the same police officer?
Yes, yes, yes. And the name was passed on to the corruption command. Nothing was ever done. This guy was allowed to retire without incident in Thailand. And that's where he remains to this day.
Well, look, you brought up so much there. What about these two girls that died, though? I mean, in this particular case, how did that make you feel at the time?
Well, absolutely broken. And what happened was, it wasn't just the police officer involved. There was a judge involved, and he was involved in altering the sentences if any of the older prostitutes were ever put before him, which were involved in also, you know, in this bigger racket procuring kids, right? There was someone senior in the music department in the BBC involved. So all this information was pushed over by myself to the senior officer running the vice unit within the Metropolitan Police, and he threatened me, right, with the loss of my home, my job, and my children if I was to ever disclose my findings. He went on to say that I had no idea who or what I was dealing with, and if I continued with this investigation, I would be thrown to the wolves. And he pleaded with me to back up and said, you'd have no idea what you're dealing with. So the girls, a trial did go ahead, which got absolutely no publicity. It was the first ever case under the new 2003 sexual offences legislation to cover grooming and prostitution of children. It was orchestrated, run by a woman. She was convicted and given 15 years imprisonment. We hear nothing about that in the paper, right? Nothing at all in the press. And shortly afterwards, the trial, the youngest victim, the bravest victim, was found dead in suspicious circumstances with an overdose of drugs, and shortly afterwards the second one. So reduced the indictment from 36 witnesses down to 2. That was the Crown Prosecution did that, and then both them girls ended up dead. We got a woman, a known prostitute to the police, who was known for being involved in young girls. We got her convicted for the first time in a British court. Right, she got 15 years imprisonment. And there was hardly any press coverage of it, hardly any. There was never any follow-up regarding the judge, never any follow-up regarding the police officer or a member of the BBC. Nothing at all was followed up on that.
Was the judge involved in that case? So is he, did you manage to keep him out?
No. He had connections to the prostitute that was running the vice ring. And after, just shortly after the conviction, both girls were found dead of suspicious drug overdoses, both of them. One of them, her grandparents to this day campaign for justice for her. They've even been interviewed by the BBC, and they scream a cover-up by social services and by police.
If they're interested in supporting them, can you tell, how can we find them? Do you know?
Their names, whether they're still alive, I don't know, but their names are Linda and George Tomsett, T-O-M-S-S-E-T-T. Their little girl's name is Zoe, Tom Sitt. You can Google her and you can find details of the case there. But there was a bigger picture going on here. And, you know, we're seeing a lot now in the press coming out, but we never hear anything of the investigations that I partook in London, and never hear of the aggressive way in which the senior management of the Met Police threatened to take away my home, my job and my children if I spoke about, you know, the child prostitution in London.
Well, well done for speaking out about it. Anyway, that's John Wedger there, former detective constable in the Met in child protection. Martin, one of the most interesting things he says there is even in that specific case, the he was talking about, the Crown Prosecution had a look at it, that he had 36 people that wanted to give evidence in the case. The Crown Prosecution whittled it down to two that were later killed.
Yes, because what we're talking about here is the prostitution of young girls to powerful people, police officers, judges. Now, we're not talking
about the BBC.
Yes, and we're not talking about Pakistani taxi drivers, are we?
No, exactly. So this is the point that John is making at the very start of the interview, which you can hear on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, is a very small part of what is actually a much bigger system. And I did ask him, because it's the obvious question, saying, look, this was a few years ago, John, back in the noughties. What about today? What evidence have you got that is still going on?
Said to me, this girl's a liar. She's a liar. You know, and then the system intervenes and the kids go into care. How safe are they there? Well, I'm going to tell you now, right? When I was working on a child protection unit, I went to the child protection office in Haringey, it was a borough in the UK that had more kids' homes than any other borough in the country. There were 26 children's homes in a very small inner city borough. And I asked the sergeant in charge, do you have any cases of child prostitution, as we termed it back then, on this borough? And I was told, no, none. Right? And I said, is there any capacity for me to look into? She went, yeah. We had an officer looking at it. She's on maternity leave, and in the 2 years she was looking into it, not one case. I instantly got a list from social services of all the children's homes. I picked up that list. I rang the first kid's home up, and I said, how many kids have you got? Explained who I was. They went, five. I went, how many of them do you lose at the weekend? They went, three out of five. I said, do you know what happens to them? They went, yeah, a car picks them up, and they're taken off to saunas and brothels. I then rang up the next time. Within 10 minutes, I'd found 10 children. Within 10 minutes. So we had the Rochdale thing with three girls. Look, in 10 minutes, I'd found 10 kids. By the end of the week, I found 52 children. I held a meeting, a multi-agency meeting with social services from that borough and the neighbouring boroughs of Camden and Hackney. I brought in NGOs that purported to look after kids. And I brought in the lead for child safeguarding for one of the major kids' charities. I relayed my evidence, and I was threatened by the safeguarding lead for one of these major children's charities that I was treading on toes and I was to back down. And then that whole investigation was shut down. 52 children that were being pimped out. One of the boys that was being pimped out was so advanced in AIDS that he had abscesses in his anus, and he would collapse when he was interviewed by social workers, and they just ignored him and they continued him to be pimped out. This is an appalling state this country is in, right? And when I was threatened, you know, with the loss of my home and job and children, they stopped the investigation, they scaled it down to two children. They never investigated another case of child sexual exploitation, grooming, whatever, until they were pressurised in the backlash of the Jimmy Savile inquiry. You know, and this is London. So if we think and we know that Muslim grooming gangs are preying on kids in Rochdale, Rotherham, and provincial towns, what is the figure for London?
It's a great question. Martin, what is the figure for London?
I've no idea, but it doesn't surprise me this kind of thing has been going on for generations. It happened in Victorian London. It happened in Georgian London. And, of course, the powerful get away with things. More to the point for the kind of politics show that we're on here is the use of child prostitution as a means of blackmail by the Secret Service.
Well, actually, John does go on to say that at the end of the interview, which you can hear on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later on, or you will be able to hear, is he explains that that was one of the main objectives of this, was that many of the people who we now see on our TV screens as celebrities and politicians have been trafficked, filmed. They've been trafficked. They've been with these trafficked kids. They've been filmed. And that the whole purpose of this is blackmail, and much of it is centred in London. But then I asked him about the sort of wider thing in the whole of society. What's happened to a society that allows this sort of thing to go on, and actually an establishment which condones it and threatens anyone?
Years ago, right, and I'm talking on a perverted level, years ago, if a politician or someone high up in business or in the police or whatever, right, was a homosexual, right, they could lose their job. They could be shamed, right? So, and they could be bribed. But now that it's not illegal, it's not seen as a problem. And then cocaine. If you had a drug addiction, you was an opium addict, a cocaine addict, again, it was taboo, it was disgraceful, it was wrong. And if you was an adulterer, the same thing. But society allows these things now. It doesn't see a problem in them. But there is not one wave of society, demographic, community on this planet which allows paedophilia. Not one. They've even done anthropological studies on communities in the Amazon Basin and Papua New Guinea that were outside of jurisdictional law. And they found even there that they deal harshly with anyone who's suspected of being a paedophile. One of the things they do is they banish them to the jungle on their own for 2 years, with a good chance they will die. So no one, no community allows it. And it has massive, and I mean massive, blackmail value. If you can get that level of dirt on someone, you have them in your pocket forever. And that's why it is so heavily managed, so heavily looked at. It's got blackmail value. And with these grooming gangs, it wouldn't have just been Kashmiri taxi drivers dealing with them girls. There would have been local councillors, local businessmen involved as well. They would have been. So why would their criminality against kids be any different to all the other grooming gangs that are operating?
Yeah, so I think John does a pretty good job there in explaining why what Elon Musk's intervention is purely political opportunism, and people like Jess Phillips just don't get it at all, and there's no way that she's going to do anything to get to the bottom of the corruption going on within the police, the Home Office, and within the judicial system, Martin.
Well, I mean, let's put Jess Phillips aside a minute. Let's talk about the bigger issue of what's going on here. There's always been the case that the powerful have abused their power, and of course there's an awful lot of abuse that goes on within families. As I said, over 100 children every year.
Well, you seem to be sort of excusing Jess Phillips here.
No, I'm not excusing her.
So why did she stop this inquiry? This is what kind of
you'd have to ask her, Tony. There's already been one inquiry.
We don't need to ask her. We know why, because she's covering up for the establishment immediately.
Not necessarily.
Yes, she is.
Well, you're saying that, and I'm not necessarily agreeing with you, okay?
Right.
It's freedom of speech. You say what you want, and I'll say what I want.
So, yeah, well, so there shouldn't be an inquiry. Jess Phillips is A-OK. She's not just there as some sort of public relations person for the establishment, isn't she?
She's a politician, Tony.
She was babbling away. She didn't really seem to know what she was talking about. She isn't around her brief at all. She doesn't know what's going on. What's she safeguarding?
That's her brief. She's in charge of safeguarding for the British government. She's an elected politician. Elon Musk isn't elected by anybody. He's the world's richest man.
In a way, he's a sideshow here, isn't he?
Well, he is a sideshow in one way, but what we should be talking about, let's all, he did, Elon Musk did definitely mention the Jimmy Savile case. And I mentioned earlier the King Cora Boys Home case, which of course when Ken Livingstone became an MP, that was what his maiden speech was about. The use of prostitute, but they weren't prostituted, they were just given to people to be used. And we know that boys from King Cora ended up in Britain. It didn't just happen in Belfast. Nobody was prosecuted for any of that. MI5 people were involved in that. They should be in prison, shouldn't they? Yeah, if they're doing that, that's criminal. Yeah, isn't it, Tony?
Yeah, well, maybe yes. Jess Phillips should be too. Yes,
well, no, because she's not done anything criminal, has she? She's just made it. There's already been an inquiry. Now, I understand that pressure is now building up for a second inquiry. Andy Burnham has called for a second inquiry. We need an inquiry into all of this, not just in Rotherham, but in London. Maybe we need to look in the King Cora boys' home and then put some people from MI5 and MI6 down in prison. What about it?
That's what we're doing here. We are having our own little inquiry into it. Because, in fact, the media is the world's final court of appeal, in a way. You know, this is what we do, is when the judicial system breaks down, because judges are involved in prostitution rings and maybe being blackmailed, then in which case it's time for us to say something and people like John Wedger to say something. From Patricia this week, Ode, Musky Bin. Elon, on dodgy role it seems, poking nose in Smarma's dreams, mouthpiece for Steve, another scam, usurp the Don, perhaps the plan. While Jess to jail, he says, must go, as grooming truths on speed now grow. Rochdale, a front of hatred, see, while groomers loom in London B. In plain sight, so many crimes, but Muslims blamed most every time. Jez and Keir push genocide in plain sight before our eyes. False flags now see where'er we look, they play to win, come hook or crook. A game opaque they play with ease. Confuse, abuse, MPs, disease. Those who know the groomer's song, still in power, still going strong, cover up, look over there, blame the Muslims, who's to care? The underdogs take the cane. A billionaire, BlackRock, Musk's game. Elon, his snout, in our affairs, something odd hides in this lair. Smarma now on holiday, perhaps a breakdown on the way, perhaps his time at number 10, job done and dusted until then. Wes Street arrives, a weffy crank, old boys of red behind, think tanks. Confuse, abuse and cause outrage, their plans in ink upon the page. From leaders, bleeders, old men of bloat, in counting house, death deals, see, gloat. Mouthpiece, see, musky, dusty bin, front man for evil, greed and sin. Thanks, Patricia. I think we need to wind up, Martin, by now looking a little bit at New Orleans and Lebanon. Let's look at Lebanon first, because the parliament has just voted and elected a new general, Joseph Aoun. Do you know anything about him?
Yeah, well, he's another guy.
President, yeah, new president.
Yeah, the other guy, the guy for Michel Aoun used to be the president of Lebanon. It's actually quite a complicated setup, because to end the civil war, and even before the civil war, you've got a sectarian constitution in Lebanon. So the president always has to be a Christian. Okay? Only Christians are allowed to be the president. Only Shia are allowed to be the Speaker of the Parliament. It's a very complex setup. And it's a complex setup, a bit like the Northern Ireland setup, because it's to prevent civil war, which of course the Israelis are keen to prevent.
Which the American fomented in the first place.
Yes, indeed. And of course the French before that. They created
and the British.
The British created the Palestine situation. Yeah. But anyway, so this guy, what happened was, as I was reading about this earlier, the Shia representatives in the parliament, which is basically Amal and Hezbollah, in the first round of voting, they refused to vote for him. And in other words, that would have meant that there was still no president. Okay? So he had to go and talk to them, because he is the candidate of the Western powers and these raiders.
Oh, God. Right, hang on, let's just have a listen, because Craig Murray did do a little tweet about this earlier as well.
This is Craig Murray here outside the parliament in Beirut, where they've just voted and elected a new president, General Joseph Aoun. This comes at the end of a remarkable period of transformation in the Middle East, and a period in which the United States, Israel and Saudi Arabia are plainly the winners. Aoun was openly the United States man who was
somebody they were trying to push into the position. The US Special Envoy, Amos Hochstein, Israeli Defense Forces veteran, has been here the last few days canvassing for Aoun and canvassing with politicians, telling them to vote for Aoun. And it's not only been the Americans. In there today in the parliamentary meeting was a special envoy of President Macron, France being the former colonial power. The French were openly promoting General Aoun, and so were the Saudis. The Saudis also had a special envoy in there today, and Mohammed bin Salman has been advocating for Aoun. And you'll not be surprised to hear that the new puppet ruler of neighbouring Syria, al-Jolani, himself a puppet of Saudi Arabia, United States, Israel and Turkey, was saying he wished to see Aoun installed here. So this is transformational. There are now American-sponsored presidents in power in Syria and in Lebanon. And this is a massive blow to the prestige and influence of Iran. It's a huge blow to the Shia minorities in both Syria and in Lebanon. And it's transformational for the Middle East. And the great victor in all of this, of course, is Israel, which is not only concluding its genocide in Gaza, it is still in occupation of southern Lebanon, and it is now in occupation of large tracts of Syria. So bad news for the Palestinians, major advance, quite a triumph really, for the Biden administration in its last throes. The United States is now in a much more powerful position in the Middle East than it has been for many years.
Well, that's a pretty objective analysis, I think. Michel Aoun, I think, is the...
Sorry, just to say, it's Craig Murray, former ambassador to Uzbekistan and various other places. Also a good friend of Julian Assange and Alex Salmond.
Yeah, Michel Aoun, who used to be the president of Lebanon, he was allied with Hezbollah. So in actual fact, this guy that's been made president, many in the Christian community don't trust him. And of course, it's actually quite complicated, Lebanese politics. I mean, if you're an anorak about politics, Lebanon's a good place to study, because it's a very complicated picture that you've got there.
I mean, it seems to me much more important that your president is Lebanese and interested in the Lebanese people rather than whether they're a Christian or not, because this guy, it's almost irrelevant whether he's a Christian, well, surely, because he's more a US, he seems more interested in the United States than he does in the Lebanese people.
Well, he's what he is. This is the Lebanese constitution. The president has to be a Christian, unless we're going to change the whole constitution.
So you could have Tony Blair as their...
No, because he's not Lebanese.
Oh,
right.
Yeah,
so in other words, what's going on in Lebanon, which is, could be a very successful country, but of course it can't be a successful country, guess what? Because it's right next door to Israel. And in fact, if Lebanon was a successful country...
So the Israelis have made various attempts to invade, etc., haven't they? They've failed. Right. So what they've done is they've just destroyed the country from within.
Well, that's right. So
in other words,
like apartheid South Africa, is oppressing the people in South Africa, but most of the damage they did is in what were called then the frontline states, in Angola, Mozambique, where South African-backed militias and terrorists killed millions of people and caused starvation. And, of course, the Israeli state, since its inception in 1948, has created war after war in the Middle East. They have basically destabilised all of their neighbours. They've only got a few million citizens, but they've managed to destroy the lives of millions of others in the neighbourhood. And of course, people in Lebanon and Syria, they know very well what the real problem is. It's the existence of the state of Israel, because they can only carry on existing by smashing and destabilizing the lives of their neighbors. So obviously there's a massive economic crisis in Lebanon. The banks have, everybody's lost their savings. There's a huge poverty. And of course, and of course, Syria is now a kind of war zone. This is exactly, it's all in the Oded Yinen plan from the 1980s by the Israelis. They're trying to smash up and destabilize all of their neighbors so that they can do what they want. And we are supporting them. We are currently bombing Yemen from Akrotiri in Cyprus, which shouldn't be, you know, why are we in Cyprus? What about sovereignty? Somebody should tell Nigel Farage, what about Cypriot sovereignty? Why a British base in Cyprus bombing Yemen? And that's our taxes paying to bomb Yemen.
In a way, what's going on with Akrotiri is it's sitting there as a provocation, isn't it? The idea is, oh, please, Iran, please hit this, and then we can really up the ante and ramp this war up.
Well, I think what might happen, because of course the 60-day ceasefire in Lebanon is about to run out, and Hezbollah only agreed to that on the understanding that the Israelis would stick to it. But of course, once it runs out, they can go back to war. And of course, by that stage, the Iranians may have come into the fight. And as I said earlier on in the show, once the Iranians come into the fight, it could well be that, I mean, for example, British destroyers in the Red Sea are going to be sunk and everybody on board is
so
going to die.
What is Donald Trump going to do about all this?
He's going to go to war with Iran to keep the Israelis happy.
So?
That's what he's been elected
so?
For.
Well,
yes.
Possibly, possibly not. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Jeffrey Sachs, because Donald Trump retweeted Did you see this?
I saw this, yeah.
This thing by Jeffrey Sachs. Let's have a listen to him now. Just say, before, you probably know him better than I do. Who is Jeffrey Sachs? You've known him, at least been aware of him for many years.
Yeah, well,
you?
Jeffrey Sachs is a very senior US economist. He's quite a sensible economist in some respects. You know, he's not a super free marketeer, but he was involved in the designing the Gaidar plan, which was the shock privatisation in Russia in the 1990s. Now, he's actually backtracked from that. He wasn't, at the time, we used to think he was definitely a problem because he was encouraging them to do all sorts of stupid things from my point of view. But of course, he's actually backtracked from that now and said I was wrong about
he's
that.
He's become pretty outspoken.
He's
anyway.
Become very outspoken because he's now on the way out. He's getting elderly. Yeah. And he's basically, he said the Kennedy assassination was an inside job. The Vietnam War was a fix.
It was about opiates.
Yes, well, the other thing is, the other thing he said is because he was put in charge by the Lancet of finding out where COVID came from, and he employed Peter Daszak from Eco Health Alliance to go to Wuhan to find out. But Peter Daszak hadn't bothered to tell him that the DARPA, the US military investment arm, had been funding gain of function research in the laboratory. And as soon as he found out, he sacked Peter Daszak.
Yeah, through Daszak.
And he's openly come out and said, this is an engineered virus, and it was engineered in a U.S. laboratory.
In
you can see
Wuhan.
A U.S. laboratory in the U.S.
Oh, really?
Yes, okay. I'm afraid so, Tony.
Well, you don't say I'm afraid so.
No, I'm just telling you what he said.
So the Americans just transported this virus over to Wuhan and then let it out through the letterbox.
Deliberately let it out. That's what Ronan's been. That's what Kirillov is saying to the United Nations. He's presented all. That's why he's been assassinated.
And was it in Ukraine that it was made, this virus, in the U.S.
The virus was made originally in Fort Detrick. Which was then closed down.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Jeffrey Sachs and see what Trump has retweeted him saying, because it's quite interesting.
The war in Syria, and you may actually hear from grown-up reporters who are lying through their teeth or ignorant beyond imagining that, oh, the war in Syria, yes, Russia intervened in Syria. Well, do you know that that Obama tasked the CIA to overthrow the Syrian government? Starting 4 years before Russia intervened. What kind of nonsense is that? And how many times did the New York Times report on Operation Timber Sycamore, which was the presidential order to the CIA to overthrow Bashar al-Assad? 3 times in 10 years. This is not democracy. This is a game. And it's a game of narrative. Why did the U.S. invade Iraq in 2003? Well, first of all, it was completely phony pretenses. It wasn't, oh, we were so wrong, they didn't have weapons of mass destruction. They actually did focus groups in the fall of 2002 to find out what would sell that war to the American people. Abe Schultzky, if you want to know the name of the PR genius. They did focus groups on the war. They wanted the war all the time. They had to figure out how to sell the war to the American people, how to scare the shit out of the American people. It was a phony war. Where did that war come from? You know what? It's quite surprising. That war came from Netanyahu, actually. You know that? It's weird. And the way it is that Netanyahu had, from 1995 onward, the theory that the only way we're going to get rid of Hamas and Hezbollah is by toppling the governments that support them. That's Iraq, Syria, and Iran. And the guy's nothing if not obsessive. And he's still trying to get us to fight Iran this day, this week. He's a deep, dark son of a, sorry to tell you. Because he's gotten us into endless wars, and because of the power of all of this in the U.S. politics, he's gotten his way. But that war was totally phony. So what is this democracy versus dictatorship? Come on. These are not even sensible terms.
So that's Jeffrey Sachs there. And interesting for Trump to be retweeting that, Martin, isn't it?
It is. And I think what he may be doing is he's trying to, you know, what Abraham Lincoln did when he was the president, he had what was called a kind of war cabinet, and he knew that these various people in the cabinet hated each other's guts and had got a completely different idea about what to do. So he would then let them argue, and then he would choose what was going to happen. I think Trump is trying to play that sort of game, but he's way out of his depth, really. Jeffrey Sachs should be in charge,
well,
not Trump.
Yeah, but he isn't. Causes of the collapse of the Syrian government. This is a disclosure by General Behruz Esbati. I'll put a link up to this story on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's actually translated by Mr. Musk from the Arabic. One of the senior commanders of the Revolutionary Guard in Syria. What he says, I mean, remember, he's a senior Syrian general who has found himself without a country, and I don't know where he is now or what he's up. He's maybe left the country, since obviously these people may well be after him. He says Russia was one of the main factors in the collapse of Syria. He said Russia turned off the radar so that Israel could attack the Syrian Arab Army's intelligence headquarters. He also said Russia has deceived Assad and betrayed Iran too. He said the Russian actions after October the 7th were to serve Israeli interests. What do you think of that?
Well, I've certainly been aware of these kind of opinions circulating, because I follow all of this very closely, as you know, Tony.
So has he got an agenda, or is he just saying, look, from the Syrian military point of view, this is what's happened?
I don't know exactly what's happened. He's probably got more information than me.
Is this part of the deal, do you think, maybe between Trump and Putin?
Well, people are speculating about all of these things. I would suggest that we don't know, and therefore it's speculation. That's the first thing
I'd
say.
Well, you can have a bit of educated guesswork, can't you? I mean, that sounds to me quite plausible that this is going to cause massive problems for the Syrians if Russia doesn't stops giving them radar.
Yeah, but they didn't. That was from the get-go. Because Putin has always taken the view that he's got to be a mediator between the Palestinians and the Israelis, which means that he can't, you know, the Israelis, if you remember, there was a Russian plane flying into their base in Tartarus, and the Israelis put in one of their warplanes behind the Russian plane so that the Syrian air defense picked up the Israeli plane and shot down the Russian plane, which killed 17 Russian service personnel. And at that point, Putin called in the Israeli ambassador in Moscow. And of course, there is still an Israeli embassy in Moscow. There isn't one in Dublin, for example. They were kicked out, or they withdrew the other week. And he said, look, you're really, you know, you shouldn't be doing this. You've killed a load of our people. Don't do it again. Now, lots of people in Russia, the Russian general staff, I understand, regard Israel as an enemy country. And that in actual fact, we're going to have to go to war with them one day. Let's get on with it now. Putin's role has always been, no, we're going to talk to them. Okay. Now, some people don't like that, but it's a clear instruction to the Russian military operating in Syria that they're not to intervene between Israelis attacking what were basically Iranian-backed units inside Syria. And that was a deal that was done between Netanyahu and Putin. And, of course, one of the things that Putin got out of that is that Netanyahu has not been involved in any kind of sanctions on Russia as a result of what's happened in the Ukraine. So that's the quid pro quo there. Okay. Now, what I think is probably what happened here, I'm guessing, because I'm not there on the ground, the Syrian Arab army fell apart because it hadn't been paid for months. they've been under sanctions, even though Assad won a democratic election in 2014 and that health situation could have been stabilised. The West was unwilling to accept that and have been carrying on the pressure on the country, so that eventually you've got a situation where conscript soldiers aren't being paid, nor are their officers, and they melted away. That's what's going to happen to the Ukrainian army. If this grind carries on, they won't get through to the end of the year in 2025 in Ukraine. The army will collapse. The Syrian Arab army collapsed for exactly the same sort of reason. If you keep grinding away, eventually they fall.
Would you like to say something about the attack in New Orleans, where some guy just drove his car into a whole load of people? There was also one in Magdeburg in Germany too over the Christmas break.
And there was also one in Los Angeles with the Tesla truck. Well, I mean, obviously what's going on the internet is most people are saying, who are sensible, as what I would regard as sensible, is that these are false flag attacks, a bit like 7-7 we were talking about earlier. I mean, the one in New Orleans, right, he crashed into it and he just started shooting people, and then they found an ISIS flag. I found an ISIS flag, and then they put it on the floor. Craig Murray's pointed out, put it on the floor, and it's actually on the floor, as if it had been laid out on the floor, so people can photograph it. Yeah, so they've got the end, and of course it's the wrong way round, as Craig Murray points out. That's an upside down flag. This guy spoke Arabic, so he's not going to put the flag upside down, is he? So, and it's not even clear that the flag was in the truck. And of course, what happened in Los Angeles is the guy supposedly shot himself in the head and then carried had a little bomb in the back, even though he's a special forces soldier, he could easily have created a proper bomb. And of course, all of this.
Yes, I don't know if anyone was killed apart from him. I don't think they were.
No, that's right.
It was all kind of fireworks popping off.
Yes,
it was almost
right.
Like some kind of
yes.
Almost like the LA mob had decided to sort of stick two fingers up at Trump and Musk at the same time, using one of Musk's cars in Trump Tower.
Yeah. Well, what we're dealing with here, we've been talking about it for the whole show, so there's no reason why we can't carry on talking about it. The deep state in the West is determined to have a war with Iran, and they're still determined to carry on fighting the Russians, even though they're going to lose. And one of the things they're doing, as Trump comes to power, they're trying to push him into a corner where he's got to do what they want, just as they did last time. He wanted to withdraw US troops after Timber Sycamore from Syria, and the Pentagon just said, "No, we're not doing that, mate." And then, of course, Trump, I've seen a clip of Trump last week at the time saying, "Yeah, but people say I've kept the troops in Syria, but I only kept them there to steal the oil. That's what they were stealing the oil. That's what we're doing." That's what the establishment in the West don't like about Trump. He says the quiet bit out loud. We're in Syria to steal the oil.
It was interesting that
is what is going on.
The British son, I think he was, or stepson of Tiggy Legbourg, from the royal family, was killed in that attack. Although, you know, maybe that he had some views that someone didn't like. That's possible. But more interesting is Jenny Tare. She is a reporter from the New York Post. The day after the attack in New Orleans, she was shown around the terrorist's home.
That's right.
Unbelievable. Let's have a little listen to her report, and then you can say something there, Martin.
We are here inside the New Orleans terrorist home. You can see that it's been clearly destroyed, the door at least, from the FBI raid yesterday. But if we walk through the home, we see some signs of what he was up to. He had this work area here, lots of different chemicals splayed around, and different electronics. This is, again, a work setup. Left receipts, just very unkempt in here. If we go over here, actually, you can see the Department of Justice documents here, the search warrant, and the property that they recorded here, which seems to be a lot of chemicals. Again, just left in disarray. There's a bedroom back here, and his what appears to be his collection of religious materials, his Quran, an open Quran with a passage there, as well as even the Bible here, but mostly books on Islam, and his prayer rug just to the left of me here.
So that's Jenny Tare, I think it's Tiber or something, from the New York Post. She's interfering with the crime scene there. What's she doing? How in the hell did she get into
well,
that?
Well, that's right. Room? I mean, people don't ask themselves the obvious question. This is a crime scene. It should be sealed off behind a tape, and the forensic people should be going through it. But no, we've got a journalist wandering around. Here's his Quran open on a certain verse. And, of course, there was a kafir in there, you know, which we all know is a symbolic of Palestinian resistance. Yeah. Who this do is you from
the this? This is the Movement Murdoch Empire, of course, who yes. is very much part of the genocide.
Yes, and in actual fact, as we know, it's quite possible that the Israeli Mossad were behind 9/11, 7/7 and these attacks, because what they're trying to do is get the West, including the United States, to go to war with Iran. They've made it absolutely clear that's what they want. These people are attacking you. You know they're attacking you because we're helping them. Now, you might say, well, it's a suicide attack. This guy, you know, he wouldn't kill himself, would he? People can be manipulated. There's such a thing as being a patsy. Okay? They can be recruited, they can be told to do something, and then they go and do it. We know this can be done. It goes back to MK Ultra in the 1960s. And increasingly, of course, in the world at large, people are aware that the Western intelligence services, particularly the Mossad, you know, the ones that carried out all those pager attacks, they are incredibly devious and totally immoral. And they want war. And we are letting them make us have one, because we've got a load of useless politicians who are absolutely spineless and are not prepared
what
to stand up.
What about the press?
Well, the press are well paid for what they do, are they not?
And what about the what is the subtitle for Mossad?
By way of deception to make war.
Well, I want to change that. I think it should be all the world's a stage. Because that seems to be the way they operate.
Well, that's
they,
right, but
as these guys from the pager attacks said to Rafi Berg, these ex-Mossad people, or so-called ex-Mossad, whoever they are, that is what they're doing, is they are basically writing a script for a disaster movie and then making it news, making it happen and introduce it as a real war.
Well, what happened on 9/11, of course, is that five dancing Israelis were spotted filming on their phones and all the rest of it of the first plane hitting the first tower and then celebrating, high-fiving, flicking cigarette lighters. Turned out they were all Mossad and they had advanced knowledge of the attack. They had Netanyahu didn't turn up on 7/7 because he got the Jerusalem Post phoned the embassy and said, "What's happened with Bibi? Is he all right?" Says, "No, he's fine."
It was Associated Press. It was the Associated Press in Jerusalem, actually.
Yeah, okay.
Him.
Well, I mean, the point is that he had warning in advance. Okay. Also, the Israeli Defense Forces were tipped off in November of that year that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China, even though there hadn't been a single case reported. What all these three things got in common? They've all got in common that the Israeli intelligence service had advanced warning of each of these things. Now, in actual fact, if I was Sherlock Holmes, I'd say that makes you suspects, doesn't it?
Well, actually, the other suspects, of course, are the FBI in the attack in New Orleans. And we've mentioned Johnny Walker already, who I knew and worked with at GLR. Another chap I worked in, I did the phones on his program, is Chris Morris. He was interviewed. He's the comedian. I haven't heard a lot from him for a long, long time. Here he is being interviewed by Jon Snow on Channel 4 News when John was still doing it. Jon Snow famously said, "Well, I'm never going to be working for MI5. They've approached everybody here," but I said no.
Who is the biggest recruiter of terrorists in the USA? And two, what would you do if you were broke, about to lose your house, and someone offered you $100,000? And that's really, the answer to the first question is, rather surprisingly, the biggest recruiter of terrorists in the States is the FBI. Mm-hmm. And the answer to the second one gives you the clue as to how our story works. Because the FBI have accidentally, it seems, developed a system which works rather well. And the system is, they make up a terrorist plot, they find someone to try and carry it out, and they arrest them for doing that.
And then get the kudos for having fought the great war against terrorism.
Well, they get all sorts of things, really. I mean, it's quite complicated, but I guess the essential element of our story is that these people are not terrorists, but the government ends up putting them in jail.
For very long
time. As if they were. Yes, 25, 30 years. And there's a close to 100% conviction rate in these cases. And I wasn't looking for this. I wasn't aware of this. I mean, I think we all sort of have a vague idea that the FBI may be involved in setting people up. But then when you follow the story that I did and you see it close up, it's jaw-dropping.
It's really shocking and very, very hard to believe. And yet the statistics, once you lay them out, are quite extraordinary. I mean, we're talking about 100 incidents of the FBI doing this, 100 known incidents.
More. Yes, I mean, I say it's based on 100 true stories. That's a sort of notional 100. It's in the right ballpark. It's more likely 300. But
300 times the FBI have managed to pin a crime on essentially innocent people who were just part of some casual grouping, who they trained to be terrorists and then arrested and jailed.
Yes, if I may take the FBI's side for a second, it sort of works like this. You're freaked out by 9/11. You have to cover yourself because you're implicated in some of the sloppy procedures that led to 9/11. So you talk the threat up. You say there's a sleeper cell in every city, and then you go and find it. Now, you don't know what you're looking for. And classically in the FBI, you talk about other people. You look at brown and black people.
So there's Chris Morris there speaking to Jon Snow, good old Chris. I wonder what he's up to these days. Wish him the very best. But Martin, he's explaining there he's talking about a fictional drama that he's done, created on the facts to do with the FBI.
That's right. And the other thing that he didn't mention, of course, is sometimes they allow the attacks to go ahead, like the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, when the FBI created the whole plot, and they, you know, basically everybody involved it was totally infiltrated. And the people who were infiltrated said, well, presumably you're going to arrest the people now just before they carry out the attack, because the FBI had supplied the explosives to the group that planted the bomb in the truck at the bottom. In the car park. And the FBI said, no, we want you to blow the bomb. And the bomb blew up and 6 people were killed, and then the FBI arrested everybody. Oh yes, we've got all these people, there they are, because it was their plot in the first place. But they allowed 6 people to die. Similar things happened in Northern Ireland, Tony. Similar things happened all the time in Italy in the 1970s. People need to wake up about the real danger represented by Western intelligence services and police forces, who are indeed terrorists, in cahoots with the Saudi Mukhabarat and other people like that, including Mossad.
Before our final item on the Nazis, what about good old Charlie Skelton? Over Christmas, they were telling me that it was a relief editor at The Guardian on Christmas Eve that published his article, Martin. Jens Stoltenberg, the former Secretary General of NATO. He said Director General, which is sort of similar term from the civil service. But he is now been made the co-chair of the Bilderberg conferences. So does that surprise you?
Well, not really. Let's face it, he's definitely been a glove puppet for the deep state for many, many years. Incidentally, of course, he was originally a Labour politician in Norway, and when he was a young man, he was quite anti-NATO. He didn't want NATO, Norway to be in NATO, but he's made up for that since.
What about who? Stoltenberg?
Yeah.
No, Stoltenberg's Danish, isn't he?
No, he's Norwegian.
Is he? Yeah. Okay.
Rutte's
Dutch. I thought he was Danish, but anyway.
No, he's not Danish.
Because the Danes have just been told by Trump that they're going to have, Americans are going to take Greenland.
Yes, except that the Danes aren't accepting that. I was reading interviews with people in Greenland today, and they actually want independence from Denmark, a bit like Scotland wanting independence from the UK, but they don't want to be ruled by anybody. And, of course, why they're interested in it is because they're now moving into the Arctic, because, of course, the Arctic is becoming, because of global warming, the Arctic is becoming more accessible. The Russians have developed these new nuclear-powered icebreakers. They're going to have a whole new way to get goods around the world using the Arctic. And, of course, Greenland has got loads and loads and loads of rare earths, all sorts of things there, very small population. Obviously, Trump wants it. But I think that they're going to find that the Greenlanders don't want it. And, of course, many of the Greenlanders are Inuit, and they don't like the history of the United States of America and the wiping out of the traditional peoples. And they are still traditional peoples, and they don't want to be ruled by America. And, of course, even if they were ruled by America, they're saying, well, basically, in Danish elections, we've got our own parliament here, but in Danish elections, we vote socialist.
So Stoltenberg, the Norwegian, sorry about that, has already made a statement to the press about his new role, telling the Norwegian newspaper Dagens Næringsliv that Bilderberg, together with the Munich Security Conference, is a good platform for cooperation between leaders in the political arena, business and the academic world. But he doesn't really talk about starting World War III there, does he?
No, but that's what we're doing. I mean, World War III started a long time ago, and he's very much one of the guilty parties talking about Nuremberg, eh?
Yes, well, I don't, yeah, it's kicking it off, isn't it, to make it really crazy and much, much bigger. That's what seems to be the mission right at the moment.
It's 2025's great task, Tony, isn't it? Let's get it all really going.
And, finally then tonight, it's Mark Felton. He's been doing a fantastic job exposing these various Nazi plots. Particularly the fourth, looking at the Fourth Reich, he's getting stuck into that, and he's found this guy called Werner Neumann, who was in Hitler's inner circle, but quite an obscure chap who did an amazing job in actually getting loads of ex-Nazis and ex-SS people into German politics after the war.
Naumann was able to remain in a POW camp in eastern Germany for about 4 weeks, after which he escaped and successfully went to ground in the Soviet sector, using an assumed name and working first as a farm labourer. In 1946, he crossed into the French occupation zone, where he completed an apprenticeship as a stonemason to support himself. He worked as a mason at a large industrial concern in the Ruhr until February 1950, but this was a useful cover for his real work. For Dr. Naumann had begun to organize a secret network of former Nazis and SS officers that would become known as the Naumann Circle, an embryonic Fourth Reich. Naumann's underground Fourth Reich included a degree of spy tradecraft as well. Its members were extremely secretive, and communications were made using personal couriers, and false addresses and code names were employed. Monthly meetings of the controlling committee chaired by Naumann were held from February 1952 onwards. The international aspects of the organization were also extensive. Due to the diaspora of Nazis abroad, many via secret rat lines to South America and elsewhere, Naumann's organization had contact and dealings with many Nazis in South America, including some close to local governments. Seven former Nazi Gauleiters were members of the Naumann Circle. Friedrich Karl Florian, Alfred Frauenfeld, Josef Grohe, the aforementioned Karl Kaufmann, Hartmann Lauterbacher, and Gustav Adolf Scheel and Paul Wegener. Other top Nazis included SS Standartenführer Gunther de Alquen, who was the publisher of the SS newspaper Die Schwarze Korp, SS Obergruppenführer Werner Best, head of the Gestapo Administrative Office, and later the civil administrator of occupied Denmark, SS Obersgruppenführer Paul Hauser, senior wartime general, Goebbels's former adjutant Schwegermann, SS Brigadeführer Franz Zix, former Einsatzgruppen mass murderer, SS Brigadeführer Edmund Wesenmeier, Reich plenipotentiary in Hungary and a convicted war criminal, SS Brigadeführer Paul Zimmermann, SS and police leader in the Soviet Union during the war. The overall aim of infiltrating political organizations in West Germany was to eventually supplant the democratic parties and turn the country back towards a Nazi-type governance, some kind of successor to the Nazi Party, in effect the Fourth Reich. Some of Naumann's infiltrated people worked to get laws passed to grant a general amnesty for war criminals and other attempts to cleanse the recent past. The FDP in particular became the focus of Naumann's activities, the French press noting in 1952 that it was transforming itself into, quote, a nationalist and reactionary movement of the extreme right, end quote. U.S. intelligence believed the FDP and affiliated organizations were part of an extremist bloc. So how successful was Naumann's organization? One in five FDP members of the Landtag, the Regional Assembly of North Rhine-Westphalia, had a Nazi past. Similar Nazi infiltration was found in other German states from the 1950s through to the 1970s. For example, in May 1950, the New York Times reported that 53 former Nazi Party members held elected seats in the Bundestag, the West German parliament.
Well, it sounds like this chap, Werner Naumann, did quite a good job. Once the 40s had finished, he'd been squirreling away various organisations, messages, secret ways of communicating up until around about 1950, when it really started to kick off, and he had a whole bunch of agents inside German politics who were passing laws to exonerate Nazi war criminals in Germany.
Yes, and it's all very interesting, but what's missing from that is the role of Western intelligence services, particularly MI6 and the CIA, in facilitating all of this.
Well, Harry Beckhoff was working for MI6. He was doing denazification.
Yes, that's right, but of course they didn't...
But you're right. You've reminded me, when he talked about this on this programme a long time ago, he's passed away now, but he said that he got some guy who was an ex-Nazi who was managed to get promoted to become a top person in Cologne University. He pointed out this guy's a Nazi. He tried to get him removed. And there was a big hoo-ha in the House of Lords. Somebody said, no, this guy's not a Nazi. He should stay there. So they had a bit of a battle, even in the late 1940s, because there were people within the British political system who were actually supporting these Nazis.
That's right. And of course, Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head up the Gestapo, he basically said to his American interrogators, I've got all of these spies inside the Soviet Union. Do you want my spy network or not? And they said, well, when you put it like that, the answer is yes. And of course, Stepan Bandera and Ante Pavlovich, they lived in Germany after the war. Bandera and Pavlovich were definitely war criminals. Pavlovich used to head up the Croatian Ustasha state. So, going back to that era, there has definitely been linkages between the Western intelligence services, NATO intelligence service, and Nazis, and all of them linked in with Mossad and all the rest of it. People do not realise how powerful these organisations are. They think that what we watch on the television about politics, the stuff we were talking about earlier about Jess Phillips or whatever, this is a puppet show. Behind the puppet show is this is what we're talking about, as the Russian general staff well know.
Yeah, which is why they're taking the whole thing so very, very seriously. Right, Dave, is it February we're back? Yeah. So we're going to be off for a couple of weeks as Dave is off on his holes. We'll be doing a pre-recorded show for the next few weeks, but it's time to sign off right now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to John Wedger and to UNN for their interviews this week. You can and to sound engineer Dave Pazenko. Happy holes, Dave. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews there and story tips, or you can go via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page. Subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it, you can also donate or even set up a small monthly subscription at thisweekoneword.org.uk. You'll also hear, I mean, I like to plug Chris Wynn Flintoff's show, but David Miller's going to be on there on Sunday. I'm shadowbanned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You can get my paperbacks, firstly about deals between Churchill and the Nazis, that's the Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group, that's £15, and also my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Diana assassination. That's called The Siege of Heaven Reader. Get those via Bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and 11:05 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream, and over Sunday breakfast at CambridgeRadioQUK.com. Do please feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the Eastone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available for your Apple or your Android phone. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. We'll be back live in February. Up until then, it's pre-recorded, as I said just now, but have a relaxing an enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday, pre-recorded at 5 p.m. It's a war on God, but God's gonna win. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters or the synagogue of Satan get you down. We'll be right back.
die for liberty. But I can never lay down my life for no amount of money. I'm willing to die for mama, die for papa, die for John John too. But to die for a dirty dollar, there's one thing I will do.
Got your own way.